It's my great pleasure to introduce August Napoli, who will set up our next panel. Mr. Napoli is recognized as one of the nation's leaders in strategic philanthropy. He's currently president and chief operating officer of the Summa Foundation, a nonprofit that supports patient care, medical education, and research. The foundation is part of the Summa Health System family, one of our sponsors. Before joining Summa, Mr. Napoli served in numerous leadership roles at the Cleveland Clinic Foundation, the Catholic Diocese of the Cleveland Foundation, and the Catholic Charities Corporation. So please welcome me to join me in welcoming Mr. Napoli.
Good afternoon, everyone. I wanted to bring you greetings from the other big swing state in this election, Ohio, and from Akron, where the Summa Health System is based. Interestingly, while we're here enjoying lunch and the stimulating conversation today, Joe Biden is in Akron, Ohio, hopefully talking about health care. And on behalf of all of the sponsors, I wanted to thank the West Wing Writers and the White House Writers Group for putting on this conference. What a novel concept that we should actually talk to one another about health care reform. While our conversation is focused on the national level, we all know that health care, like politics, is local. The vast majority of Americans get their health care at hospitals just like Summa. And in many places like Akron, as manufacturing jobs leave, stethoscopes are replacing smokestacks as an economic engine. Summa is the largest employer in our community and the largest charity care provider. As you heard Dr. Koenig speak this morning, we are also an integrated system that has managed to get beyond confrontation to cooperation between health plan and providers. We've seen what is possible when we all work together. As this debate is dominated by the five big P's in this debate, providers, payers, politicians, pharmaceuticals, and the press, we hope that a sixth P, patients, is put at the center of the debate, and that the voices of local community hospitals and health systems have a voice in the debate because we have a lot to say. Two of the major players in that debate, two senators who have already staked out leadership role on the issue of health care, will be joining us by live satellite feed from Washington for a discussion led by Jim Barnes. Republican Senator Tom Coburn is a doctor who specializes in family medicine, who's delivered more than 4,000 babies into this world. He was elected to the U.S. Senate from Oklahoma in 2004. Democratic Senator Ron Wyden has been a leader on health care issues in Congress for more than a decade. He was first elected to the Senate from Oregon in 1996. Both have authored major health care legislation that is helping to drive the debate in Washington today. Together, they can give us the inside scoop on what it takes to move beyond partisanship to actual reform on Capitol Hill. It is my pleasure to turn the program back over to our terrific moderator, Jim Barnes. Thank you.
Senator Coburn, Senator Wyden, thank you very much for joining us today. We've heard a lot of talk about markets and mandates, and I think that you can both give us at least a brief outlook and description of your plan. So I would just ask Senator Coburn, you're the family doc. Why don't you go first? Could you just explain your plan for us?
Sure, and thank you for the opportunity to do that. And let me first of all say thank you to Ron Wyden. We both have good plans. I like mine a little better than his, but there are several things that are common in our plans, and so we're not totally divided on every issue. I believe there's three rules of medicine that we ought to apply. to reforming health care. And the first is do no harm. We have the best health care in the world when it comes to sick people. And all the statistics bear that out. We also produce about 80% of the innovation, and we spend more in our country on research than all the rest of the world combined. We should make sure whatever we do, we don't damage that. The second thing we need to do is to listen to our patients. You know, that's what we're taught in medical school. If you listen to the patient, they'll tell you what's wrong. All you have to do is look at what's out there today and see what is wrong. And what is wrong is there's minimal freedom for those that have health coverage. There is an insurance or a government agent between the patient and the physician, which limits the ability to give better care than what we're given today. And then finally, there's a limitation in terms of freedom to choose what is best for you. Somebody's telling you what is best for you. And I believe physicians and their patients, if they had less constraint rather than more, could do a very efficient job in taking care of the health needs of Americans. The key points in our bill is we equalize the tax payment, the tax credit, so that everybody benefits equally in this country as far as a tax deduction or a applied tax credit if for health care. Right now, people range from getting all the way up to almost $3,500 worth of benefit from the IRS because they have that, whereas the lowest people get about $105. That's an inequality. That's a civil rights issue that we ought not to tolerate. The second thing we do is we really create markets. We allow people to choose and to have informed choice, and they make decisions about what they want. Part of the assumption on every other plan that's been offered, whether it's Senator Obama or Ron's, is basically you may get to pick the plan, but the plans are limited. You cannot, under an HSA plan today, get a deductible that's high enough to cover your coexisting copays. So we essentially limit any plan to $2,600. And I'll just give you a great example. My former practice, we put in MSAs and then converted them to HSAs, and our employees have over $45,000 on average in their HSAs. Yet we can't buy a $10,000 or $15,000 or $20,000 deductible for our employees because we limit it. So the idea that we would put mandates. The final thing I would say is we change the paradigm in healthcare in our bill. We spend about $30 billion a year supposedly on prevention, for which we're getting very little. And 75% of all the expenditures in healthcare today are for five chronic diseases that basically, if we would start changing the paradigm, and this is where Ron and I agree, that we need to go to a prevention paradigm. And we need to pay for prevention. We need to pay what we know physicians have the capability of doing, and that's being good teachers. One of our problems today is we're not paying physicians for their time to be a great teacher on prevention. We don't have government programs that truly teach prevention. And yet, what could we do with that $29 or $30 billion if we really applied and changed the paradigm to prevention? The demographics are going to eat us up, and we're going to have a shortage of about 225,000 physicians by 2018, which means the problems are going to get harder for our doctors rather than less, and less time will be capable for them to really give the attention to the patients they need. So, freedom of choice. We address malpractice issues and tort issues in our bill. We address alternative resource for chronic disease on people that are hard to insure. So we have pretty well addressed treating the whole patient rather than just the symptoms of the patient. We're trying to attack the disease.
Thank you, Senator Coburn. Senator Wyden, why don't you give us your vision?
Jim, thanks very much. And Dr. Coburn has made a number of important points, and I think if I was sitting in the audience there, I'd be wondering why in the world, after 60 years of people in Washington, D.C. yakking about this subject, going back to Harry Truman, why would it be different this time? What actually has changed that's going to make it possible to really get this done? The legislation I've been involved with that I have authored with Senator Bob Bennett, the senator from Utah, member of the Republican leadership, is called the Healthy Americans Act, S-334. And this is the first instance, Jim, in the history of the United States Senate, going all the way back 60 years, where a large bipartisan group of senators have joined as co-sponsors. We have 8 Democrats and 8 Republicans as co-sponsors of the Healthy Americans Act. Much of the Republican leadership in the United States Senate is co-sponsoring this bill, and 6 members of the Finance Committee, where I serve, which will be a key part of writing this legislation. That is different than anything we've had in 60 years. Second, we have gotten from the Congressional Budget Office, they're the kind of numbers crunchers in the field, a very favorable financial review. I put it on my website. They have indicated that because we change the incentives that drive American health care, it would be possible a couple of years into the operation with the Healthy Americans Act of having a system that was budget neutral, and in the third year actually start to bend the cost curve downward. Now, there are a couple of key elements to this. The first is we believe it's time to modernize the employer-employee relationship in healthcare. We got into this sort of by accident in the 1940s when there were wage and price controls. Probably made some sense back then when you went to work somewhere for 30 years and somebody eventually give you a gold watch and a big steak retirement dinner. But today, the typical worker changes their job 11 times by the time they're in the 40s. So we need a portable product, and we offer that. We have complete portability under our legislation. So you would no longer have job lock. You'd be able to move from place to place. We make it clear as part of this change that if you want to keep your employer's coverage and the employer wants to keep offering it, you can keep doing just what you're doing. So we're not taking away your freedom in any way. But we're also saying that if you like one of the private alternatives that we offer in addition to your employer's plan, and these private alternatives have to be certified by the state insurance overseers, you would have that option. So for example, if your employer pays $15,000 for your health care, under what Senator Bennett and I are talking about, if you could find your coverage for $14,300, you'd have $700 to go get some great fishing in Oregon, or probably Tom would want to lure you to Oklahoma. So we are realigning the incentives in American healthcare. The only point that I would probably have a difference of opinion with respect to what Tom said is that we have in our legislation complete freedom to buy whatever you want, whenever you want it. But we think before we start subsidizing again designer smiles and all the things that can get subsidized in today's federal tax code, let's make sure that everybody can get a basic package: prevention, outpatient, inpatient hospital services, and catastrophic services. What is so, I think, unfair about today's system is if you're well off, you can go out and get a designer smile put on your face, write off the cost of your designer smile on your federal taxes, and if you're somebody who's working at a small furniture store and they don't have a company plan, not only do you get nothing, but you would end up subsidizing the designer smile. So we redo the tax code to make it less regressive and also to reward those individuals who are purchasing value, looking for good quality, doing the kind of shopping that we do for lots of other services. Last point I would mention is that as part of these efforts, whether it is Dr. Coburn's approach or mine, It is absolutely critical to change the inhumane insurance model in this country. Today, the insurance model is really based on shedding risk and cherry picking. So insurance companies get up every day and try to figure out how to unload people who have serious illnesses and send them over to government programs more fragile than they are. What we've indicated is we're going to have a very big private market, 250 million people, everybody who's not on Medicare or in the military. But those private insurers are going to compete on the basis of price, benefit, and quality. They're going to have to take all comers. They can't discriminate against those who have pre-existing conditions. And the future of the insurance market would be based on offering value rather than shedding risk. And I think that is absolutely key to any reforms. But as you can see, Dr. Coburn and I agree on an awful lot of things. So if there was anybody in the audience who thought that they were going to have a bunch of senators start slugging each other, I guess everybody at lunch today will be a little disappointed.
Give me a little time. I just want to remind everybody actually in the audience that you've got some cards on your tables. If you would write out some questions and hold up those cards, and people will come and gather those cards, and I'll try to ask as many questions to the senators as time permits. But let me just put one to Senator Coburn right now. Your esteemed colleague said, hey, you're going to be able to keep your employer plan. We're going to have a lot of private alternatives. Why aren't you one of those Republican co-sponsors of Senator Wyden's plan?
Well, you are going to have a choice of plans, but we're going to set what the plans are going to be. If you like Medicare, you're going to love Ron Wyden's ultimate development. There's 80% of what Ron's wanting to do I agree with. I don't agree with taxing all of America's employers and letting their money go through the government. Number two, of all the problems we're having with Medicare today, especially as things have changed, think about it. They have a 31% improper payment rate, and 12% of everything that they spend is defrauded. Now, they have a low overhead, and that's where he's trying to get to where we decrease the overhead. My contention is this, is that insurance isn't insurance in this country. It's prepaid insurance expense for which they extract about 26% of the dollar. In other words, we spend $2.3 trillion on health care every year in this country, and $700 billion doesn't go to prevent anybody from getting sick and doesn't help anybody to get well. We ought to change that system. Ron would agree we ought to change the system. He just wants more government in it than what I want. The point I would make is that we ought to be about creating an opportunity where we have an absolutely level playing field, where we take Medicaid stamps off of people's forehead and don't discriminate, but get everybody some equal access. Will we solve all the problems? No. His won't solve all the problems. And the more that we have government involvement, and I'm for creating a national market on health insurance, because we don't have a market on health insurance today. The only place that really works well is where we have seen government ERISA plans where they're actually aggressively working so that you don't have that insurance profitability in there. So what I would say is I can't support the plan because I don't think we ought to create a bigger government to solve the problem. A good portion of the problems we have today is because the private sector is now starting to model Medicare, which everybody knows isn't working well. And so we can go that way. But we're going to have the same problems. We're going to have a 31% improper payment rate, and we're going to have a 12% fraud rate, and we're going to have a 4 or 5% overhead rate. Well, think about what that comes up to. That's not 25 or 28%. That's 35% that doesn't go to get somebody well or prevent them from getting sick. The other thing where we're fairly strong is we want to address the tort problems in this country. The Senate has 68 lawyers in it. We'll never get true tort reform through the Senate. The trial lawyers will never happen. So we incentivize states to create health courts where people who are truly injured can get taken care of, but the dip your bucket in the pond lawyers who are shooting an arrow hoping to hit something will have to demonstrate that they have a legitimate case. And it doesn't mean you can't sue, but everything that's admitted in evidence in a health court has to go to a regular court. And the estimates on saving, we spend as physicians in this country, 8% of everything we spend in this country goes for tests that nobody needs except the doctor to potentially defend themselves against the lawyer. If we don't address that issue in some way, and ours is very subtle and very slow, I'd much rather set it with limits. And we know that works because all the states that have done it, their malpractice rates have gone down, and their ancillary tests that are not necessary when looked at in the studies are going down as well. So we ought to get rid of 6% of that 8% just by having common sense tort reform, which is not addressed. I don't believe it is, Ron. You correct me if I'm wrong. Is not addressed in the bill.
Senator Wyden,
I'm thrilled that Dr. Coburn said he supports 80% of the Healthy Americans Act, because I'm going to go back to the office and we're going to go to work on trying to figure out the other 20%. But there are a couple things. First, we do have a significant legal reform provision in our legislation, and for many of the same reasons Dr. Coburn has just mentioned. Look, the way this debate has unfolded in the past is the Democrats say it's the insurance company's fault, and the Republicans say it's the trial lawyer's fault, and everybody just goes about their merry way and slugs it out on the political battlefield. What Bob Bennett and I said in the Healthy Americans Act is we're going to have to make changes on both ends of the spectrum. Yes, we need insurance reforms for the reasons that I articulated, but we also need legal reforms as well, and suffice it to say there's been plenty of opposition to both of those provisions from some very entrenched interests. That's number one. Number two, with respect to the size of government, and this is what I'm going to work on in terms of the other 20%, we're talking about the private sector, Jim. As I say, the reforms here are to liberate the marketplace, because today we have a broken marketplace. What we've basically got today is a whole bunch of cost shifting. Is, you know, people who don't have coverage shift their bills to people who do have coverage, and so we're making the changes in the private sector. We're going to have a market for 250 million people. So I say to all the Republicans who've been talking about health reform in the past and having a government-run program, we welcome you. We welcome you because we're going to have a huge private sector marketplace. The other point I want to mention deals with this question of the role of government, and particularly the size of government. The question here is the government's role going to be a smart one that targets subsidies where they're needed, or is it going to be a foolish one that just fritters money away? And Dr. Coburn and I don't want that to happen. I think what never gets mentioned in these discussions is there is a mandate today in America for health care. That mandate is that every hospital that gets federal funds has got to see people. It sees them, however, in the hospital emergency room, in the most expensive end of the healthcare system. So let's be clear on this. That is a mandate. I repeat, it is a federal mandate. So the question becomes, are we now going to, in a bipartisan way, recreate the role of government so where there does need to be a subsidy for somebody of modest means, it's targeted on an outpatient basis, on the preventive kind of approach that Tom Coburn and I so strongly support, rather than just continue this system that, in my view, stacks the entire healthcare system in a way that doesn't make sense from the standpoint of smart use of federal dollars and subsidies that are available.
When
I'd like to pipe in just for a second.
Yes, sir.
The one thing that I think is important, no matter what we do, if we do Ron Wyden's plan, what we have to do is not stifle innovation in the market. You know, there are a lot of doctors who are trying all sorts of innovative new things today. I'll take care for your family for X amount of dollars for a year. I'll do these procedures at this. I know in dealing with my own patients where people are without insurance and we shop up to the people who I feel comfortable with taking care of my patients, we get a whole lot better price when we shop it far below what the insurances will pay and when we do it. So what we don't want to do is to say, here's the plans, and you can have anyone that meets you. But what if you have there's something that you want that's different? And I'll go back to my employees, my former employees. They would all love to have a $20,000 deductible now. Well, they can't buy it, because they are limited to the absolute amount of their copay, which is $2,600 a year the maximum we can get for them with us picking up the other $2,400 is $5,000. Well, they could say they could each save about $5,000 a year if they could buy a $20,000 policy. But that's not available because we have a federal law that limits it, and Oklahoma limits it because they've been lobbied by the insurance industry. I'll go back. Until we create real competition in the insurance market, prices aren't going to go down. Now, Ron is attempting to do that, but he's also setting parameters. Here's the things you got to have in everything. Well, what if you don't want that? What if you're a young single male and you don't think your insurance policy ought to have to pay for a married couple having kids? Why shouldn't you get the benefit of that? But as we create mandates, and Ron's bill will create mandates because it'll give these choices, but these are the only choices, let's don't stifle the innovation. Ron and I can work out the difference in that. I'm sure we can come to an agreement somewhere in the middle where we get somewhere. But my worry is that innovation is one of the things that's given us the tremendous advancement that so many of the physicians, so many of the researchers, so many of the sophisticated medical centers in this country have accomplished. That we don't want to do anything that will lessen that. Matter of fact, what we want to do is we want to encourage the same innovation in how we get cared for as we have in the care and the research that's come forward through all the investment made in this country.
Jim, I won't belabor this. Have senators just speaking at each other, but Tom's absolutely right with respect to innovation. That's why we don't have any price controls, rate regulation, global budgets, any of those kind of ham-handed kinds of things that you saw back in the debate in 93 and 94. We also sweep aside the state mandates. But we do think that everybody in our country ought to have the access to the essentials: prevention, outpatient, inpatient, and catastrophic. Certainly you can go buy anything else you want. There's no price controls in sight. But it does seem to me that we ought to make it possible for there to be a standardized effort in some of these key kinds of areas, number one. And number two, in order to have the flexibility for the young people that Tom is talking about, what we've said is you have in these key areas what amounts to a standardized benefit, or the actuarial equivalent. So we do allow for the health savings accounts and the variety of other approaches. And you've got two senators who do feel very strongly about innovation and this particularly important in healthcare, and both of us are committed to it.
Just to talk a little bit about bipartisanship, Senator Chuck Grassley, one of your colleagues, has said that the biggest obstacle to a bipartisan solution on healthcare is the difference between the word mandate and the difference between the word accessibility. I'm interested, do you feel that the ideological and the philosophical divide has narrowed at all up on Capitol Hill for healthcare reform?
Chuck Grassley is the ranking Republican on the Finance Committee on which I serve, and I am just thrilled that he's a co-sponsor of the legislation. It has sent exactly the kind of message you're talking about what it's going to take to bring the two sides together. Jim, I've gone to see 85 senators in their office just to really hear them out and get a sense of what they think needs to be done on health care. And I think what has been remarkable in 2008 is that we are moving to a philosophical foundation that we've never seen before. And this is probably, from my standpoint, one of the most important points. Republicans have clearly moved to say that we cannot fix health care unless you get everybody covered. Because if you don't cover everybody, the people who are uninsured shift their bills to the insured. So I really credit Republicans, and as I say, I've seen most of them in the Senate on the health topic moving very significantly. I also think my colleagues in the Democratic Party are also moving to make it clear that they will accept, and Tom has touched on it here, a vibrant role for the private sector to promote choice and to promote innovation. So what you have is a melding together of the Democratic ideal of getting everybody covered. We Democrats have worked on that for 60 years, going back to Harry Truman, and I think a lot of Republicans are moving in our direction, and I think my colleagues in the Democratic Party are prepared to say, look, we're not going to turn everything over to the federal government, your doctor running around with a jacket, a white jacket that says U.S. government on it. We're committed to private sector choices and innovation. And Jim, if we can keep that melding together of philosophy, covering everybody, but really ensuring a responsible, fixed marketplace with a role for the private sector, I think we can get there this time.
I think there's a great example. If you're a 25-year-old male living in Kentucky, you can have exactly the same policy as somebody has in New Jersey. The difference is, in Kentucky, it costs you $890 a year. In New Jersey, it costs you over $6,000 a year. What's the difference? The difference are mandates. Now, how did New Jersey get to where their health care is so expensive? Because politicians, if we start with Ron's bill and say, here's the minimal mandates, what politicians do is they do things based on what special interests want them to do. And we may start out with a minimal set of mandates, but we won't end up there. And that's why New Jersey hadn't ended up there, and that's why 13 to 15 of the states have unaffordable mandates and their costs are through the roof in terms of health insurance. So the question ought to be is, do we want to cover everybody? Yes. Do we want somebody that can self-insure a portion of their insurance, have the ability to buy what they want? We don't think you should have an insurance plan that doesn't give you a screening exam every year. We believe in prevention. But the fact is it's called mandate creep. And all you have to do is look at this country and you look at the tendencies of politicians. This isn't the people of the country. It's the politicians to look good to some special interest group, tack on something new, tack on something new, tack on something new. I mean, we've got five states that mandate aromatherapy as a law. Well, how do we get there? And so the danger with saying there's you can't have the freedom. We're going to decide what is the minimum that you need as an individual. Well, I don't get to choose that. The government's going to tell me what the minimum is I must buy in terms of coverage. As long as you've got coverage that will cover you for your needs based on your assessment of your economic system, and we have a tax system that treats everybody fairly instead of subsidizing the rich, which is what we're doing today, we're subsidizing the very wealthy with health care and penalizing the poor. Why don't we give this idea of how about me having the freedom to choose what's best with me and set the parameters on that? What is happening today, because there's no real market in health insurance, even people who have that are not getting good value because 40% of the premiums they pay never get spent on health care. So market forces work. When there's excesses in them, we pay, as you're seeing with the stock market in the last few weeks. You're always going to pay the penalty. And we're going to create excess, and what's going to happen is the cost curve isn't going to bend because the mandates are going to creep and they're going to grow. And that's where Ron and I have a difference. We could sit down and say, we could lock and steal what we believe today, but what would happen is when we left here, somebody would creep that mandate. And that ought to be, other than basics, what you get ought to be up to you and what is good for you. I mean, why should I pay for a facelift for somebody else if I don't want to? Why should I pay for an insurance policy that will pay for ancillary things that aren't truly health, but yet because I'm in the plans, I'm going to pay for it? And that's our problem. We don't have real market forces working. We don't have real competition in the industry. I'd make one final point. If you think we have competition in the health insurance industry, go read the 10K reports of the SEC of every major health insurance company. And what you will find is over 20% of the money they collect never gets into the health care system. So here we've got $2.3 trillion being spent, but only $1.6 trillion actually going for health care, and not near a percentage of that in prevention that should, and it's because we don't have a real market. And we won't have a real market with this either. So, the market forces are going to be necessary to make us efficient, and we won't be efficient without market forces, without real competition.
Let me get to some of the questions from the audience. And Senator Coburn, let me just start with you. We've got one question. noting that you have recognized the need for health information technologies as a basis for any reform. This person says, not passing the Kennedy-NC bill this year will cause more delays in that effort. Will you work with your colleagues to get it passed in the short time remaining in this Congress?
I will work with them, but just so you have the whole side of the story, your federal government has now spent $780 million to develop at the government level interoperable standards so that everybody's computer can talk to everybody. We could have bought the whole package for Mayo for $200 million and given it to everybody. What is going to happen? The estimated expenditures is we won't have it for 7 years under the NZ Kennedy plan, and we're going to spend another $1.3 billion to get there, and then we don't have patient privacy address. So I agree. Health IT is something that will help us all. It will save us overhead as physicians. It will improve quality. It'll improve outcomes. But you have a Washington fix on it. And the Washington fix is absolutely stupid. And what we ought to say is Google, IBM, Microsoft, get together and give us these standards, and they could give them to us in a year, and we could pay them $250 million, and we'd be done with them. We could give it to everybody. The second point I would say is the Stark provision is the biggest limitation in the penetration of IT. Where you're practicing a hospital, it is illegal for that hospital to give you software so you can talk to them back and forth on their system, and that you could talk to other doctors who also work at that hospital to transfer that IT system. We're saying that's buying doctors. That is the stupidest thing I've ever seen, because what it's doing is it's impeding the penetration of health IT. And it solves the interoperable problem, because if you have a hospital-based practice, your hospital is going to maintain the next level to achieve the interoperable plans. And as they do that, they'll be giving it to you. Most doctors' groups are not expending the $300,000 or $400,000 right now on health IT, because they know as soon as they do that, as soon as the standards come, they're going to get to spend another $200,000 or $300,000. We're the ones that are causing health IT not to happen right now because of the way we've approached this. And all it would take, and Pete Stark's agreed to this, by the way, he's agreed to take it off. It's being blocked in the Senate. It's being blocked in the Senate that we can't take that away so hospitals can freely give to the doctors that practice at their hospital their health IT system and use it and create the commonality. We'd have a 50% jump in 1 year. We'd have a 50% drop in prescription errors. We'd have this massive change and savings of a tremendous amount of money among physicians' offices if we would, that were one simple thing we'd allow it to happen.
For both of you, one questioner here, one member of our audience says, parity for mental health has been a long-term problem and increases the cost of overall medical care. Do your plans address mental health care?
The Healthy Americans Act does, in fact, mental health parity is a key part of essentially the mid-range federal employee benefit, which is sort of our measuring rod. Half the plans are richer, half the plans are less expensive. And to ensure that mental health services do get parity with physical health services, just as your questioner suggests, is something that I think is going to improve our economy. It is going to make it possible for more people to be independent, to be in a position to get help, almost always outpatient help, and I think is a very sensible and cost-effective approach. Also, my brother was jostled around in the American health system for years and years, was a schizophrenic.
Another member of our audience notes that there's been a lot of discussion about the need for more and more physicians and the physician shortage. Can you all, we can't see you, or we can see you in freeze frame. Well, let's see if we get the senators back here. One of the things that, if we get the senators back, that we can ask them about is a question that, that was on a lot of your minds, some of the questions up here, talking about is there the political will to get something done. And I know that James Carville, you know, last night, you may recall, when he was asked, what do you think about the prospects for reform? And he said, well, members up on Capitol Hill are going to be spending an awful lot of time trying to catch falling knives. And in that environment, are we really going to have the need, the ability, the will? Will members of Congress do that? And I think it's a fair question to ask. Will members of Congress actually look at? And I'm told the satellite will be back in a minute, so I won't have to ad lib.
Well, I actually have another meeting, so.
Have we got our senators back?
We're here and we can hear you.
Okay, great. We're here and we can see and hear you. So this is great.
For just a quick thought. First of all, I think it's great news that Dr. Coburn is going to pull out all the stops to get mental health, and that'll be very much in the public interest if we can remove that last hold. On the workforce question, that is so important because as Massachusetts even has seen in recent months, and they're the state that everybody is looking at in terms of trying to cover everybody, they don't have enough providers, particularly in the area of primary care. So one of the areas we're trying to strengthen in the Healthy Americans Act, and we would appreciate the input of the group, is how we're going to get more providers, because if you're having a crunch with having a sufficient number of providers today and all of a sudden you're going to add new people to the system, there's clearly going to be a huge gap. A couple of areas that we're looking at is, first, the country spends several billion dollars on workforce training programs. And as I look at a lot of those workforce training programs, often it seems that people are going to be trained for jobs that before too long are going to be done overseas. Healthcare jobs can be done here in the United States in terms of nurses and physician assistants and therapists and others. And one of the areas I'm going to pursue as part of the health reform debate is to try to transfer some of those workforce training dollars into the healthcare area. And we're going to welcome your input in other areas, certainly the whole issue of graduate medical education ought to be reviewed. And please offer up your ideas and suggestions with respect to workforce, because given what Massachusetts has seen just in the last few months, it's clear that there is going to be a huge workforce need in order to put in place health reform.
Yeah, I would also note, on Massachusetts, they missed their calculation the first year by $300 million on a plan similar to Senator Wyden's.
It's not at all similar. They don't have any cost containment because they can't move the tax code. The major driver of American health for 160 million people is the federal tax code that incentivizes inefficiency and is regressive. No state can touch it. And the fact of the matter is that Massachusetts can't put in place the strong cost containment measures that we're putting in the Healthy Americans Act, and that's why we got the favorable score from the budget officials and why Massachusetts is running in the hole.
Here's the cost containment. If we want more physicians, then you ought to be willing to pay somebody to spend 8 years of their life post-college and spend 60 or 70 hours a week working. We ought to pay them appropriately. And what we have a system now is where physician remuneration is going down. Young people are looking at it and they're saying, why would I do that? I can go get the same amount of education, same amount of training, not have a trial lawyer chasing me all the time, and I can make more money. That makes common sense. Now, we can do all the workforce training. I'm not against that. But when the market speaks and says you will not be rewarded for your investment, people are not going to go there. And Medicare has caused that. Has caused that because we've said the big fight over the 10.91% cut. Now we're going to have a 20.6% cut in 18 months. The whole game is how do we cut physicians' fees? Well, if we keep cutting physicians' fees, we're not going to have any doctors. Everybody's going to be cared for by a nurse practitioner or a PA. And that's part of the plan. Part of the plan is to transfer it away from physicians to physician extenders because we know we don't want to pay what the quality of that care from a fully trained physician is worth. We don't value it, and because we've made promises we don't have the money to keep in Medicare, we're going to ruin the rest of health care because of it.
There is an awful lot of hope in this room, but also a lot of skepticism that there can really be a bipartisan agreement on health care. One of the questions is, you know, how do we get the necessary political will for real health care reform, especially when it's not clear to me that the outcome of the 2008 election, whoever wins, Obama or McCain, is going to be seen as a real mandate for health care reform?
It's a good question, and look, people certainly have a reason to be skeptical. The federal government's only been chewing on this for 60 years. As I mentioned, we now have a few new variables we've never had before. We've got a bipartisan bill, 16 United States senators, good score from the Congressional Budget Office. Now, we don't know how the election is going to turn out in November. But one thing we know for certain is the next president is going to be a United States senator. And United States senators have been through the effort to try to get through the procedural wrangling in Washington, D.C. They know you've got to have a bipartisan effort. And what Senator Bennett and I are putting our time into is one very clear goal, and that is to generate as much support, bipartisan support, as possible, so that around November 10th or 15th, after our new president, I very much want it to be Barack Obama, the Republican sponsors want it to be John McCain, we want our new president to say to their staff around November 10th or November 15th, how in the world am I going to do health care? Neither candidate has an actual piece of legislation. Senator Obama, Senator McCain, they've got position papers, they've got materials up on the web, but they don't have an actual piece of legislation. And we hope that the new president and their staff, along about the middle of November, will say, you know, up in the United States Senate, there is a big group of Democrats and Republicans who want to work with me and my administration. Given that support, and given that we've got there what we've never had before, I want to spend political capital to go after this in the first 100 days of my new administration. Before I get banged up with every possible cause coming through my door, given the fact that there's now some bipartisan support in the United States Senate, I want to go after this early, make it a domestic priority, and that's how we hope events will unfold.
Senator Coburn, do you have a closing thought?
I'm positive about it because I actually know politicians. I took off my medical hat every day except Monday and weekends. And my skepticism is this. Politicians do what's in their political best interest. And I think the patient has to get sicker before we're going to get the diagnosis and the treatment we need. I appreciate Senator Wyden. He has worked hard on this. He cares immensely. He wants us to get something done. But the one component that has to be in any health care plan is we have to reconnect the consumer more directly with the cost of the expenditure of what they're doing. And we also have to have politicians not thinking about which party's going to be in power and how they look at home, but instead start doing something that's best for the country rather than best for their career. Look, health care in this country is great, but our kids can't afford it. And if you just know the numbers, and I know it, I don't want to get down into the weeds, but there's $85 trillion worth of unfunded liability on Medicare alone. Unless we get a system that really forces competition, really forces innovation. Our kids can't swallow it. Medicare will not exist, and a good portion of the benefit that we derive from the great investment we've made in healthcare is going to go away because politicians would rather have their position than principle.
Senator Coburn, Senator Wyden, thank you very much for participating in the forum today. We look forward to your continued role and service in trying to solve this problem.
Thanks,
thank you very much.
Okay. I'm sorry I didn't get to all of your questions. I'm sure that there may even be ways for you to pose them directly to the senators. It's a lot more fun when you can see them right up here responding. But thanks for your all's continued participation in this discussion and exchange that we're all trying to have. And I'll turn it over to John.
Please stay seated while they clear the tables, and we will continue the program given our tight time schedule. We'll now turn from Capitol Hill to the country at large and take a look at what American people think about health care reform. And to do that, let me hand you over to Chris Foster, who will introduce our speaker. Mr. Foster is chair of the U.S. healthcare practice for the global communications firm of Burstyn Marsteller, one of the co-sponsors of this conference. Chris?
Thank you, John. Thank you very much. And I want to thank the West Wing Writers Group and the White House writers for their courage and leadership and pulling this forum together. It's absolutely needed, and we're delighted to be a partner in this. As John mentioned, I am the U.S. chairman for Burstyn Marsteller. We're a global public relations and communications firm representing some of the largest pharmaceutical, hospital, biotech, patient advocacy organizations on a range of issues, including health policy. We spent much of the morning and as we just saw at lunch, talking from the perspective and listening to luminaries both from academia and physicians and policymakers. Our next speaker is going to truly talk to us about, he has his finger on the pulse of consumers. He's going to talk to us from his perspective as a public opinion expert. Mike Berlin has been in communications for the past 20 years. He's formerly the CEO of Penshone Berlin, a global communications and research and polling firm. Most recently, he's finished his stint in partnering and working as a senior advisor to Senator Hillary Clinton's campaign. So I ask you to please join me in welcoming a good friend and a partner, Mike Berlin, to the podium.
Thanks for that introduction, Chris. It's been wonderful to be at the conference, and we spent the last day or so hearing a lot of opinions of people. We've had people cite surveys, polls, and focus groups. And I have the honor of not giving you my opinion, but just giving you the facts. And we always know that the facts can be manipulated, but I will try to give a clear view of where Americans stand on health care today. First of all, I'd like to thank Clark for including me in this conference. It's my honor to come here. But let's look at it. Healthcare represents one of the most complicated issues in America today, particularly for us pollsters. Everyone agrees that we need reform, and that's where it stops. Because at the same time, the public holds deeply emotional attitudes about healthcare that make true reform a non-starter. The economic reality and the public opinion are clearly out of sync, and they have been for a long time. How long? I mean, think about where Hillary started in 1993. I mean, that's 15 years. We heard other people talk about 40 years, but, you know, it's clearly for multiple generations. The difference today is really that the tides are shifting, and healthcare reform is now being advocated by everyone, and the public is only waking up to the hard reality that things are really going to need to be changed, that it's not a problem that can be ignored anymore. Back in 93, healthcare was clearly one of the most visible issues when Hillary was proposing a universal healthcare plan for all Americans. It's the seminal event that most people in my generation and probably in your generation can remember. But in essence, she was really trying to approach it from the economic side of the issue. And she tried to bring us a public system that would be more efficient and cost-effective than the existing patchwork of private insurance plans. Sounds like a good idea now, right? But back then it was sort of met with a lot of criticism. Members of the healthcare insurance industry saw Hillary's plan as a direct threat and fought back with their famous Harry and Louise campaign. And I just thought that we might put that up. So let's see if we can get the tech to work. So let's go back to 93.
This was covered under our old plan.
Well, yeah, that was a good one, wasn't it?
Things are changing, and not all for the better. The government may force us to pick from a few health care plans designed by government bureaucrats.
Having choices we don't like is no choice at all.
They choose.
We lose.
For reforms that protect what we have, call toll-free. Know the facts. If we let the government choose, we lose. Call today.
You actually
he shoots. He scores.
Louise, Pat was just telling me his state has community rating.
Everyone pays the same rate, no matter their age, even if they smoke or whatever. Does it?
Oops.
My health insurance went from $1,200 to $3,200 a year.
With a double?
Yeah, thousands dropped their insurance. I mean, we actually have fewer covers now than before.
Congress can do better than that.
If we send them that message.
To send Congress a message on flat...
Well, look, whether we can actually see Harry Louise and just hear them, we all remember it. And why were Harry and Louise so effective? Because they hit a deeply emotional chord with the public. The message was simple. Don't mess with my health care. It was all about protecting choice, the traditional health care model that people were used to and didn't want to lose in a personal program designed by government bureaucrats. Hillary's plan was beaten back then, and little more was done on the healthcare front. But can anybody think of a more effective campaign that has shaped the dialogue in healthcare and that is cited nearly every time we try to do something? The most effective advertising campaign probably in the last 15 years, and still is one that we're dealing with today. So this year, healthcare reform is back as a major political presidential campaign issue, and one that the parties offer very different approaches and priorities. In 93, business was not behind healthcare changes, and they fought. In 2008, healthcare has truly become an economic issue for everyone, and now business can't afford it. They know something has to be done. But as I talked about before, public opinion is out of sync with economic reality. Healthcare decision-making, best doctors, best care, is not an economic-based decision today. And when it becomes one, the public fights. The economic reality is that the vast majority of people like the health care they have, and they don't want to lose it. One of the key learnings from the Hillary campaign that I was just on in 2008 was that whenever we talked about health care, we had to begin with, if you like what you have, you get to keep it. If you don't have insurance, we'll help you get it. And then the senator would wait, 1, 2, 3, 4, make sure everybody heard it. And then she would start to speak about cost, quality, and coverage. If you like what you have, you can keep it. Otherwise, it was a non-starter. So today I'd like to talk about 10 facts that I think are really shaping the dialogue. So fact number one is, who really knows the percentage of Americans who don't have health care? We always hear the number of 47 million, but how many people does that represent? And the truth of the matter is, it's 84%. So when you talk about health care reform, one of the most important things you have to realize, particularly from a political side, is you're talking to 84% who have health care and actually might like what they have. So it becomes challenging. If we look at to see who the uninsured are, we can see that the uninsured are typically lower income, nearly two-thirds are below 34, and by race, they're half white and basically half minorities, with an overrepresentation of Hispanics, who are 30% of the uninsured yet they only represent 14% of the population. Many of the uninsured are actually uninsured for only a few months. Others are young and have decided to skip coverage, or poor and eligible for Medicaid, but have not applied. Still others are undocumented workers. But that leaves many, perhaps as much of a quarter of the total, who want insurance, are not eligible for government programs, and can't afford the premiums. Their employer, often a small business, may not be able to afford a plan, or they may be self-employed. This is the most politically active group. This is the group that is now starting to feel many of the issues that we talked about today. And they're the group that I think is growing in the population and is pushing now the reform even harder. But healthcare is a worry to many voters, only one quarter, 24% of voters say that it's actually caused hardship in their life, far lower than those who say that gas prices are hardship, which is 37. So in the scheme of things, healthcare affects you if you have a healthcare issue. Healthcare affects you if you don't have it. But on a day-to-day issue, more top of mind with American voters is gas prices. And if, as a politician, if you could find a solution to gas prices, you're probably more likely to get into the White House than if you found a solution to healthcare. And in fact, if we look at it, just skip a chart here. This is one chart that I wanted to show you that young people are disproportionately affected by age. You see that 18 to 34-year-olds are the blue bar for uninsured and total population. So 22% of 25 to 34-year-olds are uninsured, yet they only represent 13%. So when the gentleman that was talking about Senator Obama's plan said that we need to get young people into the system, they actually represent a disproportionate amount of the people who are currently out of the system. But if we go to the next chart is what is the most important issue in your vote for president? And what you can see is I've divided it between Republicans, Democrats, and Independents. By far, the economy is the most important issue. 43% of Republicans, 54% of Democrats, 50% of Independents. And I suspect if we took this survey today, it would even be higher. What we see is that healthcare, which is all the way to the right, is the least important issue to Republicans. It's the second issue to Democrats, and it's sort of towards the end for Independents. But if we look at the trend lines, we can see that the blue line represents the economy, which has been surging. Healthcare, which is the purple line, has gone from 21% in December to 16% by August. Gasoline prices came out of nowhere and now are more important than healthcare. So you can see in sort of the order of priority, healthcare sort of moves up and down, but for the American voter, issues of immediacy like gasoline prices can overshadow it. So for the vast majority of Americans, healthcare is really an affordability issue than a coverage issue. And although there are differences in the party among this, if we look at Democrats, their solutions typically worry about coverage. Democrats and Republicans will both worry about price, but the Republicans disagree with the Republicans that a system where everyone was covered would actually reduce costs. And if we look at some data here, again, broken out Democrats, Republicans, and Independents, everybody agrees, which is the blue line, that we need to make health care more affordable. There's less agreement on expanding coverage for the uninsured. Democrats are the most in favor of that, Independents sort of in the middle, and Republicans lag. And if we look at sort of the rationale and we ask a question, do you think that moving to a system where everyone is covered by insurance will do a lot to reduce healthcare costs? Democrats, 53%, say yes. It would do a lot to reduce healthcare costs. Only half as many, 25% of Republicans, think that universal coverage would reduce costs. And Independents are somewhere in between. And so now you see that we're really a divided country. We know there's an economic issue. We know that healthcare needs some sort of reform, but we're deeply divided on exactly what that solution should be. And if we even take it to the next level and we ask a trade-off question, do you think everyone is covered by health insurance, or do you think that we could make health insurance more available and affordable even if everyone doesn't get covered? When we look at everyone is covered by health insurance, again, that same 2-to-1 ratio among Democrats and Republicans, or if you ask, do you think we could make it healthcare more, would you support healthcare being more affordable and available even if not all were covered? We see that Republicans almost 3-to-1 favor that. So we have deep philosophical differences on an issue that perhaps should be nonpartisan. I mean, healthcare affects all of us sort of equally, but we don't know how to solve it. And so we end up with the complete gridlock that we have. And what's the issue here? Americans strongly prefer to keep the system they know. Right? People don't like to change, and particularly something that is as black box as healthcare. Right now, the vast majority of Americans prefer to get their healthcare insurance through their employer rather than on their own. So if we look at data, what would you prefer? Would you rather to get health insurance on your own, or would you rather get health insurance through your employer? We can see, or is there really no difference? You can see the red line is through the employer, the green line is the blue line is on your own, and the green line is no difference. So Republicans nominally through their employer, no difference, certainly not advocating to get it on their own. Democrats, slightly different, it doesn't make a difference to me, but I'll lean towards getting it through the employer. If we then ask them, well, if you bought health insurance on your own, do you think it would be harder or easier to do the following things? And we ask them, find a plan to meet your needs, handle administrative issues, keep insurance if you were sick, or get a good price. They all agree with that it would be harder on your own. And then being the good pollster that we are, we then say, okay, now that you've factored all this in, we've talked about what getting health insurance on your own might be. Now, do you think you'd rather get it through your employer, buy it on your own, or it doesn't matter? And now we see that this was the chart that I was talking about, where everybody feels that it would be harder. And somebody said it's perception, not reality. That's exactly right, but they perceive that it would be harder. And then if we ask the same question again, would you rather get it on your own or would you rather go through an employer, we can see that our 47 shoots up to 75 because now they've considered it. Do you see another Harry and Louise ad coming? this is what happens. The public are very fickle. And when Carville talked about the people who Carville talked last night about the people who, wake up every day and wonder if their health insurance is going to get changed or they're going to lose it. Well, this is profound fear right here, is if I have to get it on my own, look how much harder it's going to be. You know what? I'll just stick with what I have. And that's really how public opinion get shaped, because for the vast majority, for the people with insurance, for that 84% that I was talking to you about, they have a doctor, they like the doctor, and while they may accept that there's a healthcare crisis, for them, healthcare reform is not a quality issue. They like the situation they have, they like the doctor they have, and they fear any attempt at changing it. And it doesn't take much to shape their decision. The truth of the matter is people don't want to be responsible for managing their own healthcare and healthcare decisions. There is no clear system of healthcare accountability, particularly for costs. Now, that's not to say that there couldn't be a lot of education that could be done. That's not to say that a lot of what we've talked about today wouldn't work. I'm not here as a policy person. I'm here as helping you understand where public opinion lies and why it is so difficult to get anywhere. And to even take it to the next level, when we look at satisfaction with the quality of your own health care, 82% of Americans are satisfied with health care. Now, there's a lot of physicians here. That's a testament to the fine health care they receive. But the quality of health care for themselves is not broken. They're not complaining. Now, when we ask them for the country, how satisfied are you? 49% are satisfied. 49% are dissatisfied. That's like the old polling question, what do you think of Congress? I hate them. What do you think of your congressman? I love them. It's the same thing here. Is the quality of health care overall in the country? Oh, it's not working. For me, oh, it's just fine. You know, but that's, again, and if we take it to the next level and we look at satisfaction with costs, we see that it's a little bit more split at, when we get to talking about their personal situation, 56-43, but on the national level, it's 74-24. So again, what we're dealing with here is that the perception at the local level, and somebody made a point today that all of healthcare is really local when it comes down to the patient. On the local level, quality and cost, quality is fine, cost 50-50, but not nearly what we see when we look at the national situation. So what does that result in? And here I have a couple more choices just to before I go on. If we give consumers the trade-off of lowering health care costs or maintaining the choice of seeing their own doctor, 59% prefer to see their own doctor than lowering costs, which really speaks to the strength of that relationship. If we look at it at knowing I will always have health care coverage versus maintaining the choice of seeing my own doctor, okay, then we can, if we put a gun to their head and said you're going to lose coverage, then they'll give up their doctor. But even a third would prefer to see their doctor. So it's not cost. They're not willing to lower cost to give up their doctor. It has to be as draconian as I'm going to lose my coverage. So again, another sort of evidence from public opinion that this is hard to shape. So who really becomes the villain here? It's the insurance companies. They're the ones who really get saddled with it. And less than 1 in 4 Americans have warm feeling towards healthcare insurance companies. They've become the villain. The politicians, you know, aren't the villain. The doctors are just trying to get their job done. It's really the health insurance companies. And yet the health insurance companies might have been the ones that fought Hillary back in the day. So other approaches, like HSAs, have appeal, but are receiving pushback because Americans see HSAs as requiring them to do too much work. The idea behind HSAs is to give people more involvement and control over their health care costs. I've shown you some charts that say, maybe they're not so interested in all the work that's involved, and that cost-benefit at this point doesn't hurt enough. So the issue is how much control do people really want? You know, the system as it's designed today is fairly easy. You look to get the best care, not necessarily the best cost. It's really that true black box. The problem is that if people like the doctor they have, they like having a supportive relationship with him. They don't want to haggle over fees or comparison shop, but they need to have whatever procedure they need. So and then when we look at satisfaction levels with HSAs, they're not so bad. Performance of the insurer, access to preventive care and wellness services, health benefits, information offered by insurer. So the people who are in the HSAs are actually finding them to be okay. But getting people to be okay with the concept of the HSA may truly be what our problem is. So this is another example of I'm not sure I want to get it on my own. I'm not sure I want to manage it. But if I get there, hey, this is sort of better than I thought. Another area that we explored is, can healthcare be seen more as a consumer good than a human right, which all my Democratic brothers out there would say it's heresy. But, you know, is that another way to sort of frame it? You know, Walmart sees itself as an agent for consumers, is really working to sort of bring that message to the market and leading the way in trying to establish a more cost-conscious model for its employees and potentially its customers as well by focusing on the provision of basic health care through on-site clinics. They cover 1 million people already and offer the opportunity to provide a unique level of vertical integration of patient benefits from care to claim processing to prescriptions. Very interestingly, I could not find any data on how happy Walmart employees are with that system. They've kept it pretty close. So that's one thing, though, that we'll be monitoring from a public opinion perspective. Finally, another client of mine is Mike Bloomberg, the mayor of New York. And for Mike, his solution to healthcare was preventive medicine. And he got accused of creating the nanny state. But he took some unpopular measures early on in his administration to sort of deal with it. And one of the issues was smoking. So tough medicine, for politicians now I'm talking about, can work, and preventive care is another way to address health care costs. What Mike did is he banned public smoking, required companies to list nutritional information. Initially, Mike's popularity did decrease. More importantly, he was threatened. He was threatened by groups that would pull together 50,000 smokers in New York who would vote against him. It would be the largest coalition to ever throw a mayor out. And it took true courage to do what he did. And while unpopular in the beginning, the reforms really worked, and Mike's popularity surged. And what was interesting is I found some data that before the ban, 65% overall supported smoking cessation in public places. Of non-smokers, it was higher, 73. At smokers, it was only 26%. 1 year later, not surprisingly, the smokers and overall people liked it, the non-smokers, but smokers went from 26% supporting it to 37%. And there's a lesson there for politicians, is that doing the right thing is not always the easy thing. And when I heard the gentleman talk about Barack and, you know, not doing the mandate because it wouldn't sell to some people in the Midwest, where's the courage? Where's the courage to take a stand and go for it? You know, and so, and I think that's the lesson I learned from Mike, is as his political advisor, I said, why are you getting into this issue? It's so unpopular. At the same time, he was raising taxes. We were coming out of 9/11. And he said to me, because it's the right thing to do, and being a politician isn't always doing the easy thing. It's doing the right thing. And you'll see that this will work. And it has worked. And so I think that true political reform is going to have to take on some courage, because the public opinion data that I'm showing you is never going to talk about the type of reform that you all are speaking about today. So the last issue is I thought we should probably talk about the current candidates and what they are doing. And so next chart. So basically, there's two plans out there. And I'm not going to go through and read the two plans, but there's lots of data on the Obama plan, which says that he would ensure that every American has the opportunity to purchase affordable health insurance similar to the coverage enjoyed by Congress, regardless of pre-existing conditions. McCain, as we heard last night, proposes the $2,500 for individuals or $5,000 for a family. Two very different approaches. And if we looked at the public opinion data, Obama's plan is favored 2-1. And I thought to myself, uh-huh, this is another pollster trick. Because in the Obama plan, they didn't talk about costs. And yet we're dealing with an economic issue. And I thought, even pollsters don't get it right. They're not measuring the trade-off. They're just measuring the ideal wishes. And there's more work to be done. So in closing, look, the fact is that the health care debate is stuck. The public's confused. They prefer that nothing changes. The 800-pound gorilla in the room is really the powerful constituency for the status quo. The status quo being the current employer-subsidized low copayment system. Most people like what they have, and they don't want to lose it. For middle and upper income people who are left out of the system, the status quo model is what they want to get into. They want to go back into the system that they know, not some impersonal clinic or look it up for yourself system. The people who are uninsured want to go back into the black box. The clearest way to cut costs are to reduce usage, see the doctor less, reduce coverage of expensive procedures, or the Walmart system, which is company clinics for routine care stocked with doctors who can provide the service at a lower cost. The essence of these changes would be to force people to think about healthcare in economic terms. But the public rejects the trade-offs of economics and healthcare. That's the education piece. That's the piece that's missing. That's the piece that people don't get. Why? Because as I said at the onset, healthcare is an emotional issue. People want a healthcare system that reassures them, that takes care of them. They want doctors to be father, mother figures, wise counselors who know the best, and will take care of them in very scary situations. They don't want a relationship where they're haggling with doctors over prices. They want doctors who listen to their pains and fears and give them advice and prescriptions. So the economic answers, the economic answers are completely contrary to the political answers. No voter wants their own health care to be cut back. Clinics are great as long as they're for someone else. No candidate who wants votes will dare tell middle-class voters they need to accept a second-class system. Barack won't even mandate it. So this is what we're dealing with. And so in closing, how bad are things? The depth of the urgency about the economics of healthcare can be seen in the return of Harry and Louise. 15 years later, they came back. But this time, it was a set of ads from the healthcare community. Now they're enlightened views. The answers aren't simple, but the problems can be set aside. Everyone needs to come to the table. So Harry and Louise, who started us, will be hopefully who ends us. We get a picture.
Healthcare costs are up again. Small companies are being forced to cut their plans.
Tell me about it. You know, Lisa's husband just found out he has cancer.
But he's covered, right?
No, he just joined a startup and he can't afford a plan.
Too many people are falling through the cracks.
Whoever the next president is, healthcare should be at the top of his agenda. Bring everyone to the table and make it happen.
Fascinating that Harry and Louise told us that we shouldn't accept a system, we want to keep it the same. Now they're back saying, maybe it's time to rethink it. Thank you.
Thanks, Michael, for that view from the public. We'll move right on. We've heard over and over today from speakers that part of the public's concern, a large part, stems from those individuals in our society who lack health care coverage and those who live with the anxiety that they may lose coverage that they have. That will be the central subject of our next panel, a divergent set of views for sure, but all players in the game. So with that, I'll introduce our panel. Our first panelist is David Kretzer, a physician. He's a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, where he researches consumer-driven healthcare, Medicare, Medicaid, and the Food and Drug Administration. He also published a recent book,
The Cure, How Capitalism Can Save American Healthcare. Our second panelist, certainly well-known in the policy community, is Chris Jennings, who's currently the co-director of the Bipartisan Policy Center's Health Reform Project with former majority leaders Baker, Daschle, Dole, and Mitchell. After two decades of service in the White House and Congress, Chris runs his own healthcare consulting firm, Jennings Policy Strategies. Our third panelist is Pat Ford Reckner, who is CEO of the American Academy of Nursing and has spent 20 years working in national health policy and government affairs, drawing on her clinical nursing experience and community organizing training to advocate a reform. And our fourth panelist is John Seffrin, who is the CEO of the American Cancer Society and has been since 1992. He's been a leader throughout his career in alerting our nation in the perils of tobacco, leading the creation of the National Center for Tobacco-Free Kids, advising the Surgeon General, and co-chairing the Advisory Committee on Congress on Tobacco Policy, among many other activities. So those are our four panelists, and we'll focus initially on the uninsured, and we'll take your questions later in the hour. So, welcome. We heard Michael Berlin talk about public opinion. Chris, I'll start with you. You know, we've seen poll after poll over a period of many years saying the public is not only dissatisfied with the system, but a substantial proportion want the whole system restructured. Many favor a major change. Yet, as many speakers have said today, it just hasn't happened. From your perspective as a veteran of the political and policy wars in healthcare, what will it take to get the Congress to a point where expanding coverage is something that is a higher priority than it's been, say, since the Clinton plan?
Well, let me just say that share a story with you. I've been doing this now for 25 years, and my father, who is now turning 84, asked me if I should think up another profession since nothing has improved. And so one might ask, why are you asking me that question? But I'll give you my perspective. And I think it's there's several issues that I think are worth noting. First, I when people talk about coverage, I don't think they can talk about coverage without all other elements of the debate. And when we do, it actually kind of falls on its head. As we've just heard on the statistics, 16% of the population is uninsured, 84% is insured, and actually 95% of the population who votes is insured. So if it's all about insurance, frequently people say, well, it's not really going to happen because it doesn't affect me. Now, here's the difference. Cost. People are now learning that cost is and access is linked to coverage. And when we talk about coverage, it's no longer just about the uninsured. It's about the uninsured affecting me as the insured through cost shifting to people who are uninsured. If you look at the Republican governors who have been advocating health reform, whether it would be Governor Romney or Governor Schwarzenegger, what did they say? They talked about coverage reform as a necessary component of making the system work. And they would talk about it to the insured as though you're paying higher premiums because we have all these people who aren't insured shifting costs to them. I think that's now far more part of the dialogue than we've ever seen before. And if I can, I'm going to just offer, because, let me just say, in Washington, D.C., if you want to be paid a lot of money and predict and be a prognosticator about whether healthcare reform is going to happen or not, and you predict bravely that it won't, you look really smart. And I always question why people hire those people, because in the end of the day, you want the people who can tell you how to potentially make it work. And what I believe has happened over the last several years, you've asked since 1993, is we've had a lot of lessons learned. We've had a lot of changes. One is that we actually have the experience of debate of the Health Security Act. And if you look, whether it's Senator McCain or you look at Senator Obama, you see both in terms of their policy and their language about the policy, it has changed dramatically. It is no longer about this issue of I'm just covering the uninsured. I am. You can keep what you have. You know that was. If that's what you want, keep what you have. But we have changed the language and we have changed the policy, and you will see members are far more willing to work together. I have about 7 or 8 other reasons why, but I'm going to shut up other than to say one other thing, which is that the stakeholders, and by that I start with the physician community, the nursing community, the plans, the pharmaceuticals, the consumer, labor, business, all of whom are, they're no longer, what are you going to do to me? It's why aren't you doing something with me and getting something done? And that gives me some hope. And by the way, and every single one of them are saying, no longer is my second best option doing nothing. Because doing nothing has consequences. And they get that more than anyone because they deliver care every single day. So that's why I'm much more optimistic than I ever have been before. Notwithstanding, it's far more likely than it has, but it's always less likely than likely in Washington to get anything done.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you, Chris. Let me ask the other three panelists, since the main subject here is the uninsured, what your views are, either individual views or your organizational views, on the question of either expanded coverage or, as some call for, universal coverage. And David, since you're on the other end, we'll start with you.
Well, I think that we could all agree that there are too many uninsured in America. And I think that we could all agree that there are enormous problems with having so many uninsured. I think that that's probably where our agreement ends. At least we agreed on that one thing. Look, I think that we have to bear in mind how complex this issue is. It's wonderful to banter about a number like 45 million. The reality is that many uninsured are uninsured by choice. Some are well-moneyed. Regina ran over some of those numbers, but about 17% of the uninsured actually make more than $75,000 a year. And it's a very different population than some of the chronically underinsured or uninsured working poor. So I think that this is a heterogeneous population, and I think it requires two different approaches. One is we can continue with the incrementalism that we've been trying for years. I would actually suggest that it's been relatively successful in stabilizing the problem. I mean, the number of uninsured actually dropped in the last fiscal year. And that's because government programs have really stepped into the employer gap as employers have moved away. The alternative is to rethink the system. And I think that suggests that we don't just look at the uninsured, as Senator Breaux wrote a few years ago in the Wall Street Journal, but we get away from these boxes, that Medicaid is a box, and Medicare is a box, and that the employer-based insurance is one box, and those who lack coverage is another box. We take a more holistic view. I'm not sure if Washington is ready to do that. Maybe if I just add to what Chris is saying, I'm actually not as pessimistic of some changes coming in the next 4 years, regardless of who's elected president. Not because I think America has had a moral crisis or a philosophical shift. Pollsters might disagree with me. I'm not good with numbers. But perhaps because healthcare has become increasingly a pocketbook issue. The majority of Americans felt that they were doing less well in the last 7 or 8 years. In fact, median family income has actually dropped since 2000, even though labor costs are up. And the reason is health insurance costs have sucked up the money. So I think increasingly, as people are conscious of costs, they're more willing to think outside the box. Now, does that end up in a massive new plan like HillaryCare? Well, I'd bet against that, but Chris would probably say something nasty. So I'll just say that's less likely to be occurring.
Okay. Pat, give us your views or your organizations, whichever you prefer.
John, I think I've listened for a day now, and I have a number of things. I feel totally responsible for representing the 3.5 million working nurses in America. So I think one of the things I just urge everybody in this room, that there are two groups of people that absolutely have to be at the table for any discussion, uninsured, underinsured, revamping the system, and that is nursing has to be there. So I urge all of you not only to appreciate and love us for the work we do, which everyone tells me every day, but turn around and look at your boards of directors of your organizations, your hospital, your local groups, and make sure we have a seat on there. If you tell me you can't find a nurse leader, you can call me and I can find you one. because we really think it's so important that nurses be there on MedPAC, there on hospital boards, et cetera, because we have a lens that we think is very different of how we view the patient population. The second group is patients and family organizations. Mm-hmm. If they're not there, they won't buy it, they won't buy into it. So I think that's critical. The American Academy of Nursing, and two lines about us, because I don't know what people know about us, but we're a fellowship of nurses who recommend each other through a process to become fellows in the Academy. So the people who make up the membership of the Academy are the two former chiefs of staff, one to Bob Dole and Senator Dorgan. They're elected officials. They are running hospital systems as we speak right now. They're deans of nursing schools. They're provosts at universities. They're quality care experts going around the country evaluating systems. So they're kind of a unique group of individuals. But they're also very much engaged in research. So what we did is, about 2 years ago, we decided to start a Raise the Voice campaign. And that campaign is really, we require individuals to apply and become what we call nurse edge runners. And they're individuals or groups or processes that nurses are leading, and we call them edge runners, in which they have decided to try to deal with a particular problem, particularly for this topic, addressing care for the underinsured and uninsured. So while we're all sitting here today, I can tell you that Patty Garrity at the 11th Street Clinic on the shadow of Drexel University and Temple University is delivering primary care. You could actually, if you weren't a nurse, call it a medical home. We happen to think maybe perhaps it's a healthcare home, but we thought that's what we were in the business to achieve, is optimal health outcomes for all of our population. In terms of the work that she's doing, she's been able to demonstrate incredible outcomes, less hospitalizations, better adherence to diabetes regimens, et cetera. The problem for community nursing centers started, some of which started in the 80s, is they go back and they ask for a measly $50 million to scale up some of the work they're doing to expand coverage to people in the community, and they get a flat no. So I think one of the things that we decide to do is to join with other partners, which we have. I sit on the board of the National Health Council, which is representing here today, which is about 100,000 or more patients and their family and disease groups who are advocating for putting patients first, doing patient-centered, real patient-centered care. And then we're also part of the National Partnership to Prevent Chronic Disease. And I urge all of you to look at the website. They've been collecting great examples of how we can prevent and control and manage chronic disease. Some of them are nurse-managed, some of them are physician-managed, some of them are community-based and patient-managed. But to look at the examples, the innovations that are out there, there are serious practical solutions to the issues facing us in controlling the management of chronic disease, et cetera. But we just don't seem to have the guts or the heart or whatever it is to move these to the next level. And I think only through engaging the health professionals and consumers together are we going to move this in the direction it needs to go.
Okay. John, we saw in the brief clip of the new Harry and Louise campaign a couple that, at least the husband reported, that a friend was diagnosed with cancer and did not have insurance. Is that an unusual occurrence in your experiences with the society?
Not at all. It's an everyday occurrence, and that's the reason I'm here. And I would speak on behalf of the American Cancer Society, which has become the largest voluntary health organization in the world, but also strive to speak on behalf of patients. The National Health Council's motto is putting patients first, and I think we need to think hard and long about what that means and what that entails with respect to our healthcare system. And I'd also like to make the comment that I would like to speak, if I could, on behalf of 10.5 million and growing number of cancer survivors who have spatial quality care needs as they continue to survive longer. They have spatial problems that don't go away. It turns out that it was about a year ago to the day that the American Cancer Society had a press conference at the National Press Club in Washington and made the following statement, and that is that we are here as the American Cancer Society to announce that lack of access to quality health care has become a major cancer killer. And the number's large, and it's getting larger. So here as I speak proudly that we've seen downturns in age-standardized cancer mortality rates for 15 years, year over year down, and they'd gone up every year of my life until 1991, and we're saving more lives. More people are suffering needlessly and dying needlessly because of lack of access to quality health care. So, John, to answer your question very directly, it's an everyday occurrence. But it's not just the uninsured. It's the underinsured. It's the person. We had one phrase we used, are you covered? Are you sure? And what happens with a complex disease that's life-threatening if not treated properly, like cancer, many people have insurance that simply is insufficient. And so a year ago, almost to the day, we started our paid media campaign to alert the public that we do indeed have a very broken healthcare system. And with all the progress that's been made and all the things that we can tout, how we've led the world in biomedical research and the rest of it, in truth, the system we have isn't a system, but is a fractionated way in which people get care. And when it comes to a disease like cancer, that can be lethal. So we felt that if we could get the public to see the broken healthcare system through the cancer lens, someone would say, enough already. We can't tolerate that any longer. We've got to do something to fix that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Chris, as Michael Berlin pointed out in his presentation, mentioning Senator Clinton, Hillary Clinton's watchwords during the campaign about if you have coverage and like it, you can keep it. What, in broad strokes, given the lessons of 1993, how did she change her proposal to cover people that either were not satisfied with their coverage or did not have insurance, based on the 1993 experience?
Well, you know, she took on a very tough issue. She said addresses the issue of free riders as well as people who can't access it anyway. You have to deal with the issue of cost. You have to deal with the quality and value. You have to deal with the issue of insurance reforms. I mean, if you have a pre-existing condition and you're 45 years old, good luck.
Yeah.
It's not going to happen in this marketplace. And what do the insurers tell you? They say, you cannot make me cover those people unless everyone's in the healthcare system, because if you make me, then people will wait until they're sick and then they'll make me pay, or they'll make me cover. And that will increase premiums for everyone else. Well, actually, that's a viable argument. That's an actuarial sound argument. So she said, number one, I'm not going to throw everyone into mandatory alliances, and I'm not going to have a national benefit standard, and I'm not going to, if you want to keep what you have in your current employer base or any other healthcare system, you can, but we want to provide other private options for you and one public option as well. And you see, Senator Obama has done that. But she said in response, as we work with the provider community and we deal with the issues of quality and value, as we ensure access, as we make healthcare affordable through tax credits and other subsidies to make it affordable, you need to be responsible to purchase healthcare. Otherwise, it does not work. That's what Governor Romney did. That's what Governor Schwarzenegger advocated in California. So in many ways, there is a consensus. I sort of agree with Senator Wyden that we've come a long way in terms of bringing people together. Now, the far left and the far right are uniquely responsible for killing health reform. Both sides. You want to look through history? I can cite it chapter and verse. And as much as the Democrats the Democrats want more, too much, too costly. Republicans get worried, it can be government. If I hear that word one more time, you know, government-controlled healthcare system, you know, government. Well, is that really true? And this is another issue I'm just making one point about. The use of language that tends to divide rather than to unify. The idea that we're going to have a public versus private system, it's ridiculous. We're not going to have either. We're going to have some public and we're going to have some private. The idea that we're going to focus on only costs and not coverage, or coverage and not costs. The idea that we're going to only do tax credits and not direct financial assistance. The idea that it's going to be employer system, based system, or something completely different. It's going to be all these things. We will develop a uniquely American system bringing all people together, and it's not going to be any one person's plan. It's not going to be Hillary's plan. It's not going to be John McCain's plan. It's not going to be Barack Obama's plan. It's going to be an American plan. And as long as we focus on that, we can do this.
Chris, your mention of the far right and the far left reminds me of, I think, the most memorable breakfast I've had in Washington in 40 years, and it was shortly after the Clinton plan went down, and it was with Ira Magaziner and Newt Gingrich. And Newt said, you know, I just couldn't deal with my hard right. They wouldn't move. Ira said, you know, the left wing of our party just messed this whole thing up. And I was listening to this, you know, very fascinated by the conversation, and I said to Newt, I said, oh boy, I wish I'd had a tape recorder. This is great stuff. And Newt looked at me and said, no, that wouldn't be good. He said, I'd burn bridges in Washington if I did that. And I said, Newt, burning bridges? That's all he's done for the years. But David, I'm curious about your book title, How the Cure, How Capitalism Can Save American Healthcare. I equate capitalism, I suppose, with employers and the employer-based system. What's your approach to reform in relation to the employer? Would you keep the employer in the game, or would you move to an individual plan?
You know, John, I think increasingly in the United States, the debate is going to divide itself between those who support the status quo in some form, by which I mean an employer-based health insurance system, and those who are willing to move past it. And I think actually right now with the presidential election, you see those two visions exemplified, where Barack Obama, for all of his tweaking and ideas of expanding SCHIP and a variety of other things, is basically saying, look, I want an employer-based health insurance system. And John McCain, at least back 12 months ago, was talking about something much bolder, about giving a tax credit system and really moving away from an employer-based system. Now, again, both have somewhat tweaked their positions since then. I think that there's much that could be done today that would make this system work better, about choice, about transparency. Some of these things would be, I think, traditionally felt to be left-wing ideas. Some of them would be right-wing ideas, and some of them would be ideologically neutral, like information technology. But I think fundamentally what we need to grapple with is this is a system that is accidental and rises in the 1940s. And as everyone here is well aware of the stories during the Second World War with wage and price controls, employers got in the game, and the IRS ruled that it was legitimate for them to start offering better benefits in pre-tax dollars. And in 1954, that gets coded by the IRS. And before the Second World War, really practically no employers offered health insurance, something like under 7%. At the end of Second World War, it was about a third. By the late 1980s, it was up to about 90%, and obviously it's trended down since then. That's a system that works well when you're born in a Hershey town. You go work for Hershey. On the weekends, you take your kids to the Hershey swimming pool. And then you retire to the Hershey pension plan. I don't think that system of employer-based insurance makes so much sense when people who work for small and mid-sized companies tend to turn over so much. I mean, one study suggested people who work for small employers turn over every 15 months. You turn over your job, you turn over your health insurance. That doesn't necessarily just not make sense from an actuarial point of view. It doesn't make sense just from a continuity of care point of view. You switch your health plan. Very often you switch your basic providers, including your primary care doc. And I think increasingly what we need to think about is what is a 21st century solution to this problem. And I think the tax code crystallizes in place thinking from the 1940s that doesn't work today. So to go back to your question, my response is circumstantial, not tangential. I would suggest to you that we need to move past an employer-based system. That opens up other problems, but I think that is the only way we're really going to deal with issues both of coverage and cost.
Okay. There is clearly a pendulum that swings in our society on a whole variety of fronts, including healthcare, between individual responsibility and collective responsibility. And my question is, as the years have gone by, let's say the benchmark is 1993 or the early 90s, in your views, how has the pendulum moved? I mean, I'm struck at what's happened with the financial system in the last month or so, where you know the government has come with these vast bailouts and a need of you know, a collective responsibility. But it seems to me, with the advent of HSAs and a variety of other things, the kind of the erosion of the pension system in our country, placing more responsibility on the individual, that it's kind of a mixed bag. But on balance, which way do you think it's shifting in healthcare?
When George W. Bush was elected president of the United States, 47 cents on every health dollar was spent by government. Today it's 55 cents.
Okay. That's certainly an answer.
Well, you know what? I can't imagine that, given what's happening in our economy as of today, that we will not see an incredible rise in the rate of uninsured. You know, I'm hearing from the public health side, and, you know, nursing has been in support of covering, at least having insurance coverage, having a card for all Americans since, I think, 1919. We went on record for the first time to say that. And so, you know, but I'm hearing from public health nurses that, you know, the doors are getting filled, the lines are getting longer. But at the same time, the states are cutting back on services due to the budget crunch. So I think, you know, there is a groundswell that could potentially make some major changes in healthcare. I guess our concern when we listen to putting more on the consumer to make these incredible decisions in a system that is a non-system, to be, you know, in our daily interaction, and certainly as leaders in our community or with our own families, we get so many questions on a regular basis about advice and how to navigate these various issues that people are facing, particularly as it gets closer to the end of life, and a baby boomer is dealing with a frail elderly parent or aunt or friend, and it doesn't make any sense to them. At the same time, I was talking to Governor Engler. I had worked with bioengineering group before, and we were talking about the challenges we have in our educational system, and I'm concerned about health literacy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, certainly everyone in this room, I would expect, is on the computer when they have something going on to find out what's happening to themselves and to be able to walk in with a long list of questions. And I think of a personal experience in my family last year in which I had a conversation with the urologist, and he said he was talking to one of his best friends in Reading, Pennsylvania. Here he's in Washington, D.C., and he said he's so prepared when his patients come in the D.C. area because they have a volume of material in question. He talked to his friend in Reading, and he said people rely on him for the advice. So we have this difference, this divide in communication and information going on, and then expecting people to have enough understanding of all of this to navigate a very complex system. Nursing has some really serious concerns if we're abdicating our roles as health providers.
Mm-hmm. And John, I'd just like to add a point building on that. I think if and as we look toward, well, increasing or how we might take more personal responsibility, we have to understand the concomitant commitment for us to empower people to assume that responsibility. And I just want to put out there that this nation sorely needs a major prevention initiative. I mean, we live in a society that is blessed to have 90% of our babies born healthy and genetically programmed to stay healthy for most of a human lifespan, and then something goes wrong. So clearly, I think of the cancer, you know, we know that at least 60% of all human cancer is preventable during a normal human lifespan. If we were able to effect that, what a huge, huge difference that would make, not only in the quality of life, but in economic savings.
Mm-hmm. Chris, any thoughts on this pendulum? Which way it's swinging?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that we are seeing, even in the last few days, a sense of on your own doesn't make a lot of sense. Particularly if you have a healthcare condition, on your own is pretty sucky,
mm-hmm.
I have to tell you. In this country, if you have cancer, if you have diabetes, and you say, hey, have an account, go out and find healthcare, first of all, most insurers won't cover you for the account. They don't want to cover you. And then people will say, well, tell them, make them cover you. And you say, that would be a government intervention to require someone to do that. That would be hard. That would be something that's collective. then the insurers say, as I mentioned, if they can wait until they're sick, then how can you make me do that? See, these are not easy discussions that are, you know, soundbite things, but these are the realities of the marketplace, because we are going to have a market-based approach to healthcare, whether we like it or we don't like it. And it seems to me, though, that there's a broader sense that we need to do this. Now, I don't know how people can look at the individual non-group market today and say, good, let's go there. I just don't see that happening right now. Nonetheless, there is going to be a desire to have a combination of this issue of, when we say collective and individual, people say, well, yes, but. And part of the but is, individuals have to be responsible for purchasing. Individuals have to be much more responsible for taking care of themselves. Individuals should be behaviorally not smoking, they shouldn't be excessively eating, and all the rest, they should be exercising. This is all part of a discussion that needs to take place. Now, is that collective or is it individual? I would argue it's sort of both.
Mm-hmm. Many of our participants are physicians, and two of the four panelists are physicians. And my question is, and I think many physicians feel like they're not well represented in the ongoing policy dialogue. Pat mentioned that more nurses and more patients and families should be involved as well. But my question really, and Chris, I guess I'd turn to you first, since you were a battle-scarred veteran of the Clinton Wars, how you found the medical profession as an advocate for the interests of not only their own self-interest, but the interests of their patients. Whether what has always struck me as an animal who's watched and written about Washington Affairs for a long time is that physicians have been unable to harness the authority and the respect that they have in their communities where they practice, and bring that to Washington as some kind of a collective force of advocating on behalf of whatever they advocate, that it just falls apart because most of what we hear from physicians and their organizations in Washington turn on economic issues. And I've always thought the exception to that rule has over the years, but I think that might be changing too, are the pediatricians who come to Washington generally and advocate on behalf of their patients. But how did you see the medical profession as you participated in reform in the early 90s?
Well, I mean, I think I would say about the physician community that they're like a lot of other communities in that there isn't one physician community, Half the people who work, who are represented by AMA say they don't represent me. Or they'll say, you'll have the pediatricians or you'll have the cardiologists. I mean, I in my experience, I talk with them all. And I actually think most of them, in fact, I haven't met a physician who I don't believe has that their ultimate objective is the best interest of the patient at heart. I think they really do believe that. And I think any time that any party suggests to the contrary, you're just dead wrong. Now, I do think they have more credibility with the policy community when they talk about broader agenda items than just one area, whether it's medical malpractice or Medicare reimbursement rates. If it was coverage in addition to, it was quality and medical accountability and value and working collaboratively, then that actually gets a better response too. And I've had the good fortune that, as you know, I'm working with the Bipartisan Policy Center, I'm working with four former majority leaders and Dr. Mark McClellan. And of course, Dr. Mark McClellan is an MD doctor as well as a PhD doctor.
And an MBA doctor.
And MBA, he's everything. And Mark is, I think, really helpful in both conveying the practitioner's view as well as the economist's view of how we have to do this. Because healthcare is delivery, it's access, it's coverage, it's reimbursement, it's all these things, it's financing. It isn't just one thing. The last thing I'd just say about the physician community, And I think that we made mistakes in the Health Security Act. I could document many mistakes. It'd take too long to finish this panel. But one was the perception, if not the reality, that we didn't integrate the physician community sufficiently within that process. And I believe that at the focal point of Republicans and Democrats in the debate of health reform today, if you say, look at all the issues, what are they, can they come together on? It is the issue of quality, value, patient-centered care. And they want to be part of that process, and they believe if they are, they not only can improve care, but they can strain cost growth. And to me, that's very exciting. And the policymakers who ignore them and the nurse profession and many other health professionals do that at their own peril. But if they take advantage of their great desire to be fully integrated in this discussion, and if it's fully part of the every element of the discussion, not just one aspect of economic reimbursement or whatever, I think we will all benefit from that.
Mm-hmm. John, any thoughts on that?
I was just listening, and Chris, and you could validate this better than I, but I sense that we're in a whole different place today than we were in 93, 94, at least in terms of professional physician groups being open-minded. And I think they have every right to want to be engaged in the process, but I think there's an attitudinal sea change in terms of receptivity of change and looking at systemic change in ways that would improve outcomes.
Mm-hmm. Now, Pat, I don't want to leave the nurses out of this. I've always been struck at, you know, you look at most public opinion polls in terms of what vocations are most respected and the like, and nurses always are at least not number one. You know, right near the top. Yet it's been a challenge for them to really participate at the policy level on the same kind of a basis that reflects the public's respect of nurses. And you mentioned at the opening, you know, the need for more nurses to serve on boards and the like. But how would you see that picture in terms of, you know, great respect for the public, a much more difficult road to hoe in the policy community? I'm sure campaign finance contributions, are part of that mix. But what else do you see?
Well, I mean, I think it's part of what I talked about before, is that we've always been interested in seeing nurses play a more significant role in boards and commissions, et cetera. I think now we have, in partnership with a number of organizations, decided we're going to be very strategic about that. And I think that's part of what you have to do, so that we're really putting pressure on a number of sources, but also working closely with consumer organizations. And I don't know how many of you know, but the RWJ Foundation funded the AARP Foundation to advocate for nursing in America, because we turned around and said we need some other people to really make the case that if we don't do something quickly, that we're going to have you can pick a number, but in the next 10, 15 years, we're going to have a shortage of around 200,000 registered nurses. And quite frankly, as someone who's going to really need them at that point, I'm really concerned about that issue. The other part of this that I think is another thing that all of us in this room really have to stop talking about, oh yes, we really do believe in interprofessional discipline, work together, team approach, all those good things. I don't know what we're calling it at the moment. But the reality is that we have to think about the services people need. We have to identify that together with the consumer groups, find out, you know, if they need patient, education and support around following regimens, well, who can do that and who can do it in a quality, value added way, but also who could perhaps save the system some money. And I think all of the professions and all of the, direct care workers who actually do the work in home care and nursing home, we all have to open our eyes and be more, have more respect for each other's scope of practice, our abilities that we can best utilize, and kind of move over and let people do the job that we know they can do. If you talk to senators and congresspeople or state legislators or governors, they always tell me the worst thing they is in their life is when the health professionals are fighting one another. They will run to the hills. So I think we have some work to do. We throw these terms around. We all know that it will work if you do have a multidisciplinary team, and we have to really start acting and showing people that we're really going to do that, and we're going to respect each other's abilities and skills and pay appropriately for the work that we all can do.
Mm-hmm. John, let me just jump in.
Yes, Dave, please.
You know, I didn't get a decade and a half of higher education to sit out the question on physicians. There's a huge number of physicians here today. How many of you are physicians here today? Raise your hand. Tremendous. How many of you are thrilled by... No, keep your hands up. Audience participation. How many of you are thrilled by the leadership of the AMA right now? Keep your hand up if you still are. Well, doesn't that say everything? Yeah, I think the AMA went through a very difficult time about a decade and a half ago with declining membership. And I think the AMA needed to make a decision. Either they would keep on the path that they were going, or they would do things that enhanced membership or at least stabilized membership. Talking about reforming Medicare in a meaningful manner divides physicians, does it not? Some of you favor market reforms, many of you don't. Some of you favor changes to SCHIP, some of you don't. However, we all like reimbursement, particularly when we don't cut reimbursement. Am I right? And as a result, for a decade and a half now, the AMA has really sidelined itself by talking about the fact that they're against a 6% reduction in reimbursement rates and would prefer it to be a 0% reduction. Now, look, I again, would prefer no dock of any physician salary under any circumstance, but to make that position your only Medicare position is really advocating rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic. And I think that what's ultimately going to happen in America today is that we're going to have a debate, and it'll be up to you and me, the physicians amongst us, as well as other people. But unfortunately, unlike other groups, I don't think we can rely on the leadership of the AMA. I'm thrilled that you're all here from a physician point of view, and my colleagues, you know, you're the guardians of the system. You need to speak up on more than just reimbursement rates.
Okay, we have about 10 minutes left on this panel. If there are questions, we will entertain them. And there are mics out there somewhere. We can't see much up with these spotlights up here, but that's helpful. Yes, sir.
I am Simon Abonia from New York. I'm a physician.
Put it up a little further.
And we have developed a system in New York that we call it individual health insurance, paid by all and for a lifetime. That's almost all of this problem that we are talking. And the idea is that leave this present system alone. The present system is going to be improved by 100% competition once everybody is covered. And this system of individual health insurance paid by all doesn't add extra cost to the government or to the family or to the individual. And I have, because we are in the computer age and the internet, hopefully it will be approved and we can email it to everybody here. And I'm going to give all of you some samples, and then hopefully we can do that. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there other points of view or questions out there? Yes, sir.
Yes, Terry Bruce. I'm a pediatric neurosurgeon. But my question really is, in all of the panels today, there's a certain schizophrenia. And my question, I guess, about that schizophrenic thing is, we really have a push-pull between what are the social service aspects of medicine and the business end of medicine. And my question is it possible at all to blend these together and come up with a cure? Or does it have? Do we have to make a societal decision to go one way or the other?
Well, healthcare isn't the only basic need. You also have food, clothing, and shelter, and there is a push and pull between societal needs and market forces. I would say, and obviously I'm the minority on this panel, that in healthcare we've swung to one end of the extreme, and I would suggest to you in a nutshell, in 5/6 of the economy, you have individual choice and competition, and people are generally satisfied. Healthcare does not follow those rules, and that's why we're having the discussion here today on healthcare and not food, clothing, or shelter.
Yes, sir.
Hi there, Jim Knight again from San Diego. It seems to me that there's a left and a right in this crowd, and up there's a little larger left than right, but I think we all sort of subtly are concerned that one side or the other is manipulating the discussion to predicate the outcome they're looking for over the long term. And that how does one take a free market solution to health care and collaborate with a single payer advocate and get something that makes sense?
Well, I think this goes back to some of terms and realities. There's a very strong single payer community within the Democratic Party, but it is still about one third of that party. There's not a unified, this is what we're going to do, and nor do I see a single payer threat or you know, if you're afraid of it or a hope, if you want it, I don't see it happening in this world. And I think there's another word that doesn't get talked around much, but I think it really goes to the core of your question, which is the word trust. And that's that those people who are policymakers on either side are not going to go beyond certain parameters of areas, and their fundamental objective is what they say their fundamental objective is and nothing else. And it strikes me that there are people on the far right and the far left who say, I know what you really want to do. You want it to be all private, or you all want it to be single-payer government control. And I swear to you, the grand majority of the people in Washington, D.C., and the people who represent, and the people who they represent, they just want an answer to one thing. Can I have quality, affordable health care in a workable health care delivery system? That's all it is. And I don't see the far right or the far left winning out. And I think if they don't come together, I believe we will all lose out. That's what I believe.
And I think it's fair to say that over the years, the dialogue and proposals have become more conservative.
Yeah.
You think back to Richard Nixon, who proposed an employer-mandated plan. You think about Nixon's investment in the, which really sparked the beginning of the managed care revolution with providing the venture capital for the HMO development. So, which today, you know, it would be very difficult to run that uphill and see it enacted.
John, there's one thing about this that goes to motivations on both sides that might be somewhat comforting, because I don't think people always believe it's about, they don't trust altruism and they mistrust philosophical intentions. But I'll tell you, I think why a lot of people have come to the table is those on the left have moved to the right, and they've been much more oriented about what the outcome is, which is to say they'd like to have everyone to have coverage that's meaningful in some way. And a lot of those folks on the right have not been able to figure out a way to make the system work unless everyone is in the healthcare system. And then secondarily, there are people who are afraid that if the system blows up, and they're pretty certain that it's a matter of time, mm-hmm. that the response will not be, let's go to the market. It will be, let's go to single payer. So in an ironic way, all the stakeholders from the right who fear that and all the stakeholders from the left who want to have the ultimate objective, this may be a small window of opportunity where something can actually happen where this serves the interest of both. You can bet on it not happening and probably be right, but I will tell you at least it's possible now.
We have time for about two more brief questions. David,
just a very quick comment. Yeah, Jim, maybe we won't agree in Washington. Maybe we'll just have people agreeing not to agree. But maybe there is something to be found there. Maybe our bipartisan solution isn't a solution. Maybe we should devolve more over to the states and let them experiment. Governor Thompson just walked into the room. I mean, who would have thought Wisconsin would have been a leader in welfare reform 20 years ago? And yet it was his innovations in Wisconsin that showed the rest of the nation how to change welfare. I'm looking forward to finding a Wisconsin of Medicaid. Now, the left will argue that it ought to be an expansion of government. The right would argue some type of voucher system, maybe not unlike what's going on in Florida. I think we need more experimentation, more states trying to make these things work. That's why I like change and I like experimentation. Massachusetts care, I think it's probably a disaster, but I'm glad they're trying.
Please, briefly, though, if you would. Thank you.
I'm Dr. Jerry McLaughlin. I'm here representing New Mexico Medical Society. And several comments that have been made, I think, allude towards the direction I'm going with my question. Physicians have at their core and at their training that we take care of the patient. And I think we've been taken advantage of on that front in a number of sites, specifically EMTALA, where you take care of everyone that walks in the door before you ever check and see whether they can pay you or whether they will or whether there's a sword. What I'd like to see is knowing that everyone that walks through the door will have someone pay for them. How can we advocate for that and continue to take care of people? In other industries, you stop providing the service when it's not paid for, and we're not allowed to do that.
Is there a last question? Anybody else out there? Well, take that as a comment, sir. I didn't mean to turn you off.
Well, I mean, I guess the answer to your question is, if everyone had coverage, everyone would be paid, and that's what we should be working towards.
Yeah, those single payer systems suggest not much in terms of compensation. Well, maybe what
you
we
don't
ought,
know. Well, I don't
there
know,
you go again. I mean, listen, maybe what we ought to do is have more experimentation with charity.
Who's advocating for a single payer system, by the way?
Yeah. Well, your presidential candidate says, and in an ideal world, that's the system we'd have. He said that in August. He said that a year ago to the New Yorker, and he said it 10 years ago.
Is there any policy in his proposal, or is there any chance in the Congress for that ever to happen?
I'm just asking.
Do you really believe that?
Do you really think that by dramatically expanding Medicare's rules that you don't expand government?
Okay.
Mary O'Connor.
Last question.
Thank you. I just need to comment on what you just said. I raised the question earlier. Everyone being covered does not mean everyone has access.
Right.
We have the same challenge with Medicare now, where we
and
lose
Medicaid.
Money taking care of Medicare patients at my facility. The reimbursement doesn't equal our cost. So if you have somebody that just has a card, if the reimbursement isn't going to be adequate, there's going to be physician access problems. So coverage doesn't equal access.
Isn't that exactly what Dr. Redliner said, who represents the Obama campaign to you today? He completely agreed with you on that front.
No, but
he said.
Oh my goodness, a politician agrees with you.
He said that coverage does not equal access. He talked about that you had to have public health infrastructure. He said you had to have adequate reimbursement. He talked about all those things. So I guess, am I wrong?
Yes,
did he not say that?
He said,
in the room.
I heard that physicians need to be brought to the table.
And
so I must say, having lived through all our efforts every year to stave off cuts in physician reimbursement to Medicare, that I have a little discomfort that we would be brought to the table and treated fairly.
Well,
so that's based on our experience with government, with all of this. And private insurers are clearly going the way of Medicare. And the problem is, we want to take care of patients, but we have to pay our bills too. And so it's really a fundamental issue, I think, for the physicians here. How many physicians here have problems with Medicare access? You're considering limiting Medicare access.
And Medicaid.
And Medicaid. How many? Okay. And the very people that deserve our care the most.
Well,
so it's a real,
How many people here are having problems with private insurers participating in the Federal Employees Health Benefit Plan? I mean, that's the Obama plan, is that. So just to put it in the context.
All right, with that, we'll thank our panel. We're out of time, Pat. Sorry. So, thank you.
Thank you.
I wanted to raise a question about water.
You have copies of this already?
I do. Thank you. You read it and say there'll be a test. Thank you. Thanks, Chris. Yeah. Well, we'll now return to the presidential campaign and hear from a spokesman for Senator McCain and his approach to reform. I'm pleased to introduce Congressman Michael Burgess, a Republican from Texas, who will give us the McCain view of reform. He is a senior health advisor to the senator, and he also, before coming to Congress, served as chief of staff and chief of obstetrics at Louisville Medical Center in Texas. He's been active in Congress in formulating legislation to reduce costs, health costs, to reform liability laws, and to expand patient choice. Congressman Burgess.
Thank you, and thank you for letting me be here. It was really an entertaining and enlightening panel that we just heard. So going from the sublime to the ridiculous, I know you saw me on the schedule and you thought, who canceled? This is, let me just tell you, I am here as a surrogate for the McCain campaign, but I'm also a duly elected member of Congress from the northern part of Texas. I sit on the Committee on Energy and Commerce. I sit on the Health Subcommittee. And I'm the Vice Chair of the Policy Committee for the Republican Party on the House side. But I'm here as a McCain surrogate. So when I answer your question, I'm going to try to answer it as a McCain surrogate. And if I have to step out of my role for a moment, I will tell you that. So please don't go tell the press, well, you know, Senator McCain's surrogate said, because I could hear a lot of anxiety and a lot of the questions out there on things that I work on every day, the SGR, liability reform, and if those questions come up, I'm happy to answer them from my perspective as a member of Congress as well, though I will try to keep my remarks to the side of being a McCain surrogate. When we heard on the panel up here just a few minutes ago and talking a lot about the centering around cost and coverage, and I do hope at some point there's going to be a little time to talk about the patient and all of these discussions. But I will tell you, as someone who's spent a lifetime in healthcare, in fact came from a medical family, so literally all my life until I went to Congress 5 years ago, I cannot remember another time, I certainly can't remember another time when the nominee of both of the major political parties for president were talking as much as they're talking about healthcare. Now, the economy may be a wild card in this election, but certainly before 2 weeks ago, healthcare was either two or three on each of the individual lists and may in fact have swapped places a time or two during the summer. So as a consequence, and there are differences, as you've heard, there are differences in approach. And because of those differences, there will be a referendum on healthcare, and there will be a referendum on the future of healthcare this fall. And as a consequence, there will be a mandate, and there will be a structure around which change occurs. I will also say, I mean, I was just a regular guy back in 1993 trying to earn a living and pay the bills just like the rest, a lot of you in this room. I do remember, though, when the Clintons came to town, they were going to radically change how healthcare was delivered in this country. Now being in the legislative body, I can tell you that a shortcoming of that strategy was the 500 experts in the room and not including any member of Congress. And they ran smack up against people who had been chairman of their respective committees for 50 or 60 years or longer, maybe, and forgot that you have to deal with a John Dingell, or you're going to have to deal with a Charlie Rangel, presuming we don't change majorities in this next election. So whoever wins this presidential election will have to deal with the United States Congress, both House and Senate. And as a consequence, whoever wins this presidential election, I do anticipate and look forward to working with whoever is in the White House so that we can, in fact, get things done. Because I know that it is critical that we not just stay where we are. Now, for the past several months, probably since February, I've been working with and closely following the health care policies of Senator McCain. And one of the things I liked first off when I first entered into those discussions as to who was I going to support and who was I going to work with and work for in this campaign, I like the way that Senator McCain placed the individual at the center of all of his discussions. And for me, it's always been the sanctity of that doctor-patient interaction that takes place in the treatment room. After all, in medicine, that's kind of what we produce. That's our widget. That's what we make, is that doctor-patient interaction. So anything that improves that, anything that brings value to that interaction, I'm likely to be supportive. And anything that detracts is going to be very difficult for me to support. And the McCain plan wasn't just about insurance. And that's a lot of times when you hear us in Washington talk about health care and health care reform, all we're talking about is insurance or another government program. And on the McCain side, it was more centered on the individual. So it was opening more doors to more Americans for more choices when it comes to their health care. Now, the senator recognizes that the single biggest threat to our health care system is rising costs. And his plan has a set of comprehensive policies that will bring costs under control and ensure access that is affordable for all Americans. Ensure, not mandate. He will accomplish this by promoting research and development of new treatment models, encouraging wellness and prevention initiatives, and rewarding quality and coordinated care. Just like both campaigns, I think, have some common ground on investing in information technology. Now, I don't know if I've got the number here, but I certainly heard it somewhere during this past 6 months of all of this discussion. About 160 million Americans get their coverage or get their insurance from an employer-sponsored insurance plan. And for those 160 million, although there are some bumps in the road, the majority are satisfied. I know in my district I did a poll several years ago, and about 62% were either very satisfied or satisfied with the insurance coverage that they had. So clearly anyone who sets out to talk about improving the system has to start with this from the standpoint that there is a lot of good that is already out there. So Senator McCain's plan accepts that and builds upon that notion. But he also recognizes that there are some discriminatory aspects of our tax code. We heard them discussed quite eloquently, the tax treatment that has been around since the McCarran-Ferguson Act was passed back in the 1940s. There are some discriminatory aspects of our tax code, and so the senator proposes changes that will level that playing field. It's a fundamental concept that everyone should be treated equally. Senator proposes a refundable tax credit, $5,000 for families, $2,500 for individuals, that would create more choices, including keeping your current coverage. Nothing changes for the tax treatment as far as the employer is concerned. Let me say that again. Nothing changes as far as the tax treatment of the employer is concerned. So if an employer found it to be that it was a value to that employer to provide coverage for his or her employees, before, there would be nothing that would change that and make that less attractive after. That would still be an option that would be selected by many employers, many employees. What does change is that amount of money that is paid for the health insurance now will show up on the employee's W-2 form. So instead of being some sort of invisible benefit, it will become a very visible benefit to the employee. Now, a few weeks ago, my hometown newspaper, Dallas Morning News, quoted the Kaiser Family Foundation as saying that it was about $8,800 that an employer provided to an employee for the employer portion of that insurance coverage. So I'm from Washington. We can round that off to $10,000. It makes the math easier. Assume a $10,000 contribution from the employer to the employee. And then let's indulge me for just a moment to run through a couple of scenarios on how what that would mean to real people in real situations. So a family that receives a $10,000 employee contribution, and let's say they're doing okay. They're up in that upper tax bracket. They're paying 35% in income tax, so they're doing all right. 35% of $10,000 is going to be $3,500. So that family would have a tax credit available to them of $5,000, which leaves $1,500 over to perhaps put in a health savings account or use for other legitimate health expenses. So that's actually a pretty good deal for someone in the upper tax bracket. But let's go down into the 10% bracket. And someone in the 10% bracket who receives that $10,000 increase on their W-2 form will now pay additional taxes of $1,000. But they get a $5,000 tax credit. So they've got $4,000. Again, place in a health savings account, use for other health expenses. So they have more help available for their health expenses than they had before. And bear in mind, through all of this, we're using the same $200 billion of tax subsidy, if you will, that is already built into the employer-sponsored insurance program. Now, what about somebody who doesn't pay taxes at all? This is a criticism that I hear from time to time. Well, if someone doesn't pay taxes, a tax credit doesn't do them any good. Yes, it does. It's advanceable. It's pre-fundable. So that family would have $5,000 in order to use to offset the cost of either their health care or providing insurance. Another criticism is, well, you can't buy a lot of insurance for $5,000. But the reality is there are options out there, and if we will deal with a little bit of insurance regulatory reform, there perhaps could be a great deal more options available to that family as well. But you can go onto the Internet today and go on ehealthinsurance.com and find a high-deductible PPO major company like Blue Cross Blue Shield that would be largely covered by that $5,000 contribution that the government would make for that individual. But what we've done is then spread the subsidy around so it actually is a little more generous to people who need it the most, people at the lower income scale. Currently, the system is skewed so that people who earn at the upper income levels, because they're paying the greatest percentage in taxes, actually achieve the greatest benefit. And that, Senator McCain feels, is something that could be improved. Most families with employer-sponsored coverage will see little to no change under the McCain plan. In fact, the generous credit will give additional help to millions of middle-class Americans for medical expenses. But for the first time, those without employer-sponsored insurance would no longer be discriminated against, and they would be able to have help to provide coverage for their families with the insurance of their choice. So going from a world that discriminates to a world that works is extremely important to Senator McCain. In addition to retaining the benefit for employer-sponsored insurance, Senator McCain believes that no American should, simply because of medical fragility or a pre-existing condition, be denied access to affordable coverage. This is a very important priority in his health care plan. Senator McCain, as many of you know, is a cancer survivor himself. To make certain that an individual with a pre-existing condition gets high-quality coverage they need, the senator has proposed what's called a guaranteed access plan. And the guaranteed access plan builds on what are already existing state high-risk pools that are in existence in 34 states. Some work well, some don't work as well. Currently in process is the evaluation of these 34 state plans, using the best features of those that work well, avoiding the pitfalls for those that don't work well. I have encouraged them not to look at Texas as one of those models that works well, but nevertheless, they might learn some things that they don't want to do following the Texas model. I don't recall having ever referred a patient to the high-risk pool and gotten them on it, but if I did, I know I never got a check back for doing what I did to them. But that's just a little aside. But the guaranteed access provision is a very important part of the McCain plan. Yes, it is going to require that premiums be capped at some level. I cannot tell you what level at this point. It will be between 150 to 200% of the usual and customary amount of that premium. Yes, there will be help available. Obviously, there will be help available from the private sector. The insurance company will have their premium capped, so they're making a contribution. Federal and states will both pay a share of that subsidization as well. But it is that combination of public and federal and state that will provide the maximum assistance for someone who is currently excluded from the system because of a pre-existing condition. So again, you have people in employer-sponsored insurance. For the first time, someone who doesn't have employer-sponsored insurance is going to have additional help. And oh yes, people with pre-existing conditions are going to have the availability for coverage. Now, cooperation amongst the states in the purchase of insurance would also be a crucial step in some very needed and necessary market reform. You know, insurance companies, we saw how many doctors are here. How many insurance companies are here? Okay, I'll be very careful. Insurance companies are a natural monopoly. They tend to coalesce and condense. I mean, you all know this. We talk about a single-payer system. That's what we thought Aetna was in Dallas in 1995. Insurance companies do tend to draw together, but if we were to change some of the regulatory environment and allow increased competition between companies, that would provide for an additional mechanism to provide additional help to more people. We got a situation right now. I commute from Washington to Dallas. When I'm up in Washington, right across the street, for people who live in Maryland, they pay a great deal more for their health insurance than people who live in the district. On one of my congressional committees this morning, we heard testimony about how it is much more expensive to buy insurance in Governor Corzine's state of New Jersey than it is right across the river in Pennsylvania. You've got significant discrepancies across the country. An example I like to use, and since we're in Florida, we'll use the Dolphins. If a football player plays for the Miami Dolphins and is traded to Dallas, granted it's an upgrade, but that player takes their insurance with them. There's no stopping and starting of their insurance coverage. For that player and his family, there is no gap there. Now, if a fan moves from Miami because his favorite player now has been traded to Dallas, he's got to start all over again. He or she has got to start all over again. He can't take that insurance that they have in Florida and move it to Texas, and it's the same way across the country. If we would relax on that regulation just a little bit and allow people to have a little bit more flexibility and purchase insurance in markets where the cost is less, we really could leverage those dollars that we're spending for insurance coverage. And if you have a big multi-state corporation, that yesterday I spoke to the good folks at Johnson & Johnson. Of course, they have sites in several states, so they get a relaxation on some of these state mandates and are able to sell insurance that is identical in Omaha, in Dallas, and Baltimore. It's all the same for them. Well, why don't we give that same tool to the little guy and let them have that same ability to shop for a cheaper insurance if one exists? Sure, there has to be transparency. Absolutely, you have to disclose what's covered and not covered. And we heard the anxiety from the representative of the Cancer Society. But there ought to be the availability to have that flexibility. Now, we heard a little bit in the other panel about Senator McCain approaches it from a national market. There is a concept of just having a national insurance that would be an insurer of last resort, if you will. We have to be a little careful about that. I mean, heard the discussion that that's really not moving toward a single-payer plan, but the reality is if the owner of the team is also the referee, it is a little bit difficult to have an even playing field. So if you have all the private insurance companies competing with the NHIE or whatever it's going to be called, since the government is calling the rules and calling the shots, it will be a very difficult environment for the one or two people who are here representing insurance companies. It will be a much more difficult environment for them. And I think you can see in your own minds there might be a scenario where they would pull back from that market because there are other things, quite honestly, where they can make more money and not bother with the difficulties of providing health insurance. Payer play will, I think, over time, we see what's happened in Massachusetts. People find the insurance is so expensive because you got to have it, so the price went up. And actually, it's cheaper just to pay the fine and remain uninsured. But then that thwarts the intent of the program. So I do think we have to be very careful with those type of concepts. They sound attractive on their face, but there are some pitfalls there. The reality is if we continue to cling to the ideas of the past, the only opportunity for savings comes in the form of cuts in provider reimbursement. Many of you may read the New England Journal of Medicine. This is the August 21st edition from this year. Dr. John Oberlander, writing in this journal on the cost of Senator Obama's national plan, states, quoting, "Its effectiveness in slowing spending will depend on the political willingness to restrain provider payments," close quote. Now, believe it or not, I prepared this talk before I heard the anxiety in this room, but the anxiety I heard in this room is the same anxiety I hear wherever I go. My physician friends say, look, I just want to see patients. I want to do what I was trained to do. I want to do a good job. Pay for performance. Don't waste my time. I don't wake up in the morning and drive to work saying, oh, I hope I'm average today, but, you know, I don't even know if it's worth trying. No, they go to work to do their best work. Most doctors don't care what the source of payment is. They're indifferent to what the source of the payment is, and they just want to be paid so they can cover their own expenses. They operate in a very high-stress, doctors operate in a very high-stress environment, and as a consequence, most of the doctor groups I talk to say, look, all we want is for you to keep the hassle factor to a minimum. Continued provider cuts certainly constitute an ongoing hassle. Now, patients generally just want to have care when it's needed. And most are willing to pay some portion of that care or some amount each month to have the availability of that service. But what they are disinclined to do, and what's very aggravating from the patient perspective, is to pay and pay and pay and pay over time and then be denied coverage or find that the coverage is inadequate when you actually need the service. And they are concerned, patients are concerned, about the continued cuts in reimbursement limiting their access to their doctor. Now, my personal Bible, the AARP Bulletin from this month, has a little article, insurance yes, access no. And I think we heard a question that related just to that issue. Alan Greenspan, and I'm going to talk as a member of Congress for a minute, not as Senator McCain. Alan Greenspan came and talked to a group of us right as he was doing a victory lap when he left the Capitol. And someone asked him the question about Medicare. How in the world are we ever going to pay for Medicare in the future? And he acknowledged it was going to be tough, and Congress would have a tough job ahead of it, but he felt that Congress would make the necessary adjustment. I don't like to think what that was, but Congress would make the necessary adjustment so that Medicare would continue. He stopped and he said, what concerns me more is who will be able to be there to provide the services when you need them. And that actually is one of the most significant aspects of the continued erosion of the healthcare workforce that we see because of what we've done with our Medicare reimbursement. Now, I will hear policymakers up in the Capitol quote doctors. They love to quote the phrase, first do no harm. And it's a reasonable philosophy and certainly carried me through a lot of tough nights and carried many of us through our medical careers. But another phrase that I like to use as well is one used by the Medical Honor Society Alpha Omega Alpha, which is worthy to serve the suffering. In my humble opinion, Senator McCain fills both of those lofty goals. I'll be happy to take your question. Thanks for your attention. I can't see a thing. Okay. Speak up. A voice out of the dark. Oh, that's better. You are awake, I wondered.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Congressman Burgess. I'm Troy Tippett. I'm past president of the Florida Medical Association and current president-elect of the American Association of Neurological Surgeons. And I'm here to ask you about tort reform and the McCain platform. Mm-hmm. And I must say, in passing, I didn't get a chance to comment this morning on I've got a lot of scars from tort reform, having fought here in Florida for some time. And everything I heard this morning sounded like, from the other opponent's surrogate, sounded to me just like what the plaintiff's attorneys told us for years here in Florida about all the solutions we had when they totally ignored California and now Texas as a solution to our problems. But I must also tell you, I'm a little disappointed in the platform that Senator McCain has listed for tort reform, which is really not very much either. And having worked with you in Congress, I know you feel strongly that we need to do something in that venue. And could you explain to me why there's not stronger language in Senator McCain's campaign about tort reform in this country?
Short answer to the last question is no, but I'm working on it. I mean, the question about tort reform, yes, there is a fairly broad statement in the platform about the need for tort reform. It's sort of like being in favor of motherhood and apple pie. We all want tort reform. The very real success of California and the Medical Injury Compensation Reform Act of 1975, and then in Texas in 2003, right after I left practice and went to Congress, and I am speaking as an individual, not as a senator. The state passed a significant sweeping tort reform that limited caps or put caps on non-economic damages. It's a little more generous than what's available to the plaintiff's attorney in California. It's a trifurcated cap. You have a $250,000 cap on liability for the physician, $250,000 on the hospital, $250,000 on a nursing home or another hospital if one is involved. But nevertheless, it has worked extremely well in Texas, so well, in fact, that now everyone is being critical of the State Board of Medical Examiners because they can't process applications fast enough for people coming from parts unknown, but coming to Texas because of the much more favorable liability climate. And, of course, you know in neurosurgery, right before we did that reform, we almost lost our trauma network in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. We had two neurosurgeons. One of them got his bill and said, I can't do it anymore, and left. And that left one guy to cover all those EMTALA cases that you got to see within 30 minutes or go to jail or whatever it is we did to you. So it really put our trauma system completely at risk. So these reforms were very necessary. And, you know, for me, they've worked. And it's a good news story because it has worked. It may not be the perfect solution, and the people who want to argue for medical courts or more sweeping changes, I'm willing to listen to that. But I also have to listen to it with the background of I see it working every day back in my home state. And as a consequence, and again, just me talking, I introduced H.R. 3509, which is the Texas plan I introduced on the national level. People say, well, why in the world do you bother with it? Because Texas is fixed. Why do you worry about what's going on in other states? In Medicare, Dr. McClellan, when he was an economics undergraduate or a graduate student at Stanford, did a study on the cost of the Medicare system for heart disease, and it was about $30 billion a year in 1996 dollars. I'll bet it's a whole lot more today if someone were to go back and relook at it. So from a federal perspective, it's extremely important. It's an enormous cost saver if we could get that done. So, again, the other part of the answer to my question is I'm working on the senator. Yes, ma'am.
No, we.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, we have a question back here.
And then up here. Okay.
Yes, I'm Bill Pickle from Houston, Texas, and I'm John Q. Public. I'm here representing Logan Kendrick. 3-year-old was improperly intubated in February of this year and choked to death on the intubation tube. We spoke with five attorneys. I've got to tell you, it's quite intimidating being a layman speaking to congressmen and doctors and presidents and CEOs of companies. But we have spoken with five attorneys, and each one of them quotes the caps as the reason that they cannot take the case and get justice for Logan. And they say, well, I get one-third of the cap, and I have to work for 2, 3, 5, even 10 years sometimes, and it's not worth doing that, paying my staff for, you know, for an $80,000 return. My question would be, besides caps, because for you, that, you know, for I hear from the doctors and from the insurance companies, the caps are great. They're working, we're getting doctors in. The stats showed that the same amount of counties still did not have obstetricians. There are other stats that show that these doctors that are coming in are going into rich neighborhoods. Again, other than the caps, because for some of us down here on the lower end, they're not working, and these doctors are laughing at us and taunt and flaunting Proposition 12, House Bill 4, and say, get all the lawyers you want. It won't do any good.
Well, I'm going to phrase that as a question, but first let me say my heart goes out to you for what you've been through with your son. My heart goes out to you for what you've been through with the storm last weekend. I know how devastating both of those events would have been to you, or are to you on an ongoing basis. Remember, on the caps that are placed in Texas, that's not the cap on the total award. I mean, actual damages are unlimited. There is no upper limit on actual damages. The cap is on the pain and suffering. So the reality is that I don't want to speak ill of the person from whom you sought legal advice, but if a good Houston trial attorney cannot work a significant dollar amount out of the actual damages, the lifetime loss of earning for that individual, I don't know if they put pencil to paper and really tried. But the other reality is that if you continue to bleed the system, which is what we were doing in Texas, you end up with a situation that becomes absolutely unworkable. I don't know where you're getting your statistics about the results. I know from my personal experience, my old insurer of record, Texas Medical Liability Trust, has lowered premiums by 22% since 2003. Now, I no longer purchase liability insurance because I don't actively practice, but I do know from my partners in my old practice who have watched that and personally witnessed that myself. And this is an environment where those costs were going up many, many percentage points every year for a practice that really had no claims against it. Obviously, this discussion today is about more than just tort reform. Are there other options out there? You bet there are. Do I wish I could get people to open up to other ideas? Yes, I do. This we got done in Texas, and it is working well from the standpoint of keeping doctors involved in the state. South Texas, there were places where you just simply could not find a physician, and now that is improving. Medical courts, I'm all open to that. The New England Journal of Medicine had an article a few years ago that talked about the concept of early offer. Even in an environment where there was not a cap on pain and suffering, it would be average, 8 years between the time of injury and compensation. It's a long time to go. So there are other options out there right now. Unfortunately, you just don't have many people who are willing to talk about those. We did get something done in Texas because we felt it was necessary. I feel that it's working. I'm not here to offer you advice, but I think I would certainly speak to your bar association in Houston, Texas, and see if they couldn't provide someone who could direct you, perhaps provide you a little more direct help. But again, the purpose of this conversation is not just tort reform. A lot of other things we need to cover.
Yes,
there's a question up.
I'm Monica Webby. I'm a pediatric neurosurgeon in Portland, Oregon, and also the current president of the Oregon Medical Association. And just speaking towards caps, we had a cap on non-economic damages of $500,000 up until 1997, and that was overturned. And when that was overturned, our premiums quadrupled over the next couple of years. So that's the actual opposite effect of what happens when you take a cap away versus putting a cap on, which we see happens in Texas. So I think that's good evidence that a cap is provides substantial relief for us and liability issues. The other question I had for you was what does Senator McCain think about Ron Wyden's plan from the great state of Oregon?
I don't know. I was at a press conference with Ron Wyden this morning. And he got down here a lot quicker than I did, apparently. I don't know, maybe at a private chat. But I don't know. I don't. Okay. Okay. He came over the airwaves. I slept down in the on the commuter plane. I don't know the answer to that. Let me just put it in this context, and I referenced it before. Whoever wins this election is going to have to come to the Hill and going to have to find champions for what they believe in, and there will be champions on the other side, and it will be through that give and take and that negotiation. Surely by that point we'll have stopped fighting over things and we can actually work to get something done. I rather think from a congressional perspective, this is not Senator McCain talking, but from a congressional perspective, this next election may be quite sobering for many members of Congress who may have actually quite a surprise delivered by not doing as well as they thought or perhaps even losing an election that they thought they couldn't lose just a few weeks ago. I go around the country and do a lot of different speaking things on different levels, but I've just never seen so much unease in amongst, I haven't been doing this long, but there you can sense across the country there is a significant amount of unease. I think the mandate from the American people will be not only the direction we want to see healthcare go, but we want you guys to get things done, and we're tired of all the rhetoric up there. And that's, again, me talking, not Senator McCain. But also, as came up on the panel, and one of the things that I think is I actually look forward to it. You know, there are some innovative products out there, and I know I'm disparaging sometimes of insurance companies, but I have been exposed to some folks on the insurance side who are doing some very good things. I've put a panel together up at the Library of Congress next week with Ron Williams from Aetna to talk to us about the things he's done with information technology. Certainly for me that was sort of a life-changing discussion that he had a year ago at a health affairs event in Washington. I think there are a lot of things that we could get done if we just simply would put our differences aside for a short period of time and see if we couldn't get some traction on some of these things. But whoever gets elected, they will have to work with the House, and Ron Wyden will be a big player in the Senate. There's no question about it. Tom Coburn, who I think you heard from, also will be a big player in the Senate. If not a big player, he'll be a big stop sign. If he, one way or the other, he'll factor into the equation. And then, of course, on the House side, our Energy and Commerce Committee will have something to say, as will the Subcommittee on Health and Ways and Means that deals with the tax issues. So there's going to be the opportunity for a lot of give and take. And, you know, it's one of the things that I think about when I'm with groups when I'm in committee hearings, and I look around the room and I realize there's only one person on this committee that's ever picked up a pen and looked a patient in the eye and written a prescription and counseled risks and benefits, and that's me. And then when I talk to my doctor groups and I look around the room and I think there's only one person in this room who's ever had to sit through a tough committee negotiation and try to emerge with their hide intact, and that's me. So I do recognize the very significant burden that I carry going into this next year, but it's one that I'm accepting happily. But thank you all for letting me be with you today.
Thank you much, Congressman Bridges, for coming down to Florida and presenting in person. We'll now take a 20-minute break until